member Tim Meadows, storyteller and author Jim May, and musician Eric D. Johnson. Now, here's your host, a man who is hoping to get some socks for Father's Day, Justin Kaufman.
That's where you get the socks. I'm not going to lie to you, you know? I'm thinking that might be a sort of Father's Day tradition. Get socks. Like, I was in the Kohl's, I'm not going to lie to you. I was in the Kohl's not too long ago. And, you know, I was looking for socks. And 3 for $10, 3 for $20, 28, you know, like all these kind of numbers. And I'm like, you know what, I'm done with this. I'm done buying socks for myself. From here on out, that's all I'm asking for any time I have a situation where someone can get me a gift, get me socks.
Yeah. My wife calls me a popper because I have holes in everything. I have holes in all my socks. And I just, like, I keep on wearing them. I'm like, why don't I just go out and buy socks? Socks are expensive.
They are. They're sneaky expensive. It's like you'll be looking at one spot and you're like, oh, 5 pair for $12. All right, I'll do that. And then the next thing you know, you grab 3 pair for $12. And you're like, what happened? Think about the bait and switch in socks.
Yeah, you go to the Gap, you look at, oh, yeah, like, yeah, 3 for $10. And then all of a sudden you grab one that you think that's part of that pile. You take it up there. Yeah, that's $44.72.
No, those are the $44 socks.
Yeah, what?
So that's it. From here on out, every time I'm in a situation, birthday, Father's Day, Christmas, Thanksgiving, Casimir Pulaski Day, whatever it is, just get me socks. Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on this beautiful, beautiful day, this gorgeous Michigan Avenue. What a night. This is electric. People are all over the city tonight. Thanks for joining us here on 720 WGN. Lots to talk about tonight. I'm excited. I mean, we have Tim Meadows here. How great is that? Former SNL cast member Tim Meadows is going to join us to talk about. He's hosting the Breakout Comedy Festival, which is really a showcase for diverse comics. A lot of comics who've been on the show up at Second City this weekend. I think it starts tomorrow night. I think the festival started yesterday, but Tim Meadows' part starts tomorrow. But Tim Meadows, of course, longtime comedian who's been on film, television, SNL, actually calls Chicago his home. So we'll talk with Tim about his career, about hosting this, about making a switch in his career from improv to stand-up. You know, he was always an improviser. He's never really a stand-up. And just recently in his current stage, he was doing an improv show. This is how the story goes. He was doing an improv show, and the other improvisers in his show were actually on stage at Second City. This was just a couple years ago. This was after SNL and everything. And they couldn't get to the gig on time because their show, they were going across to Second City to IO or something. And so he just started doing crowd work and talking to the crowd, and they liked it because it's Tim Meadows, you know, as opposed to starting the show like that and starting with improvisation. And so then there was improv when they got there. But then he realized that, like, yeah, why not?
Do this?
I can do this. So he now is doing stand-up. He's touring all around the country. So we'll talk with Tim Meadows coming up. Also, storyteller Jim May is going to be here. Excited to have Jim here. Jim is a longtime professional storyteller here. He's got a new book out, which is exciting. We're looking forward to talking to him about the Trail Guide for a Crooked Heart, Stories and Reflections for Life's Journeys. We're going to talk about growing up in the Midwest and telling stories, and can't wait to talk with Jim. He's my guest at the big table. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we're going to talk with Dave Schwann about his National Park Service series that he's been airing here on WGN Radio, 100-year anniversary of the National Park Service. So we're going to talk with Dave about the parks in the Midwest, and we want to get your opinion on the parks, not just here in the Midwest, but around the country. 312-981-7200. You got a favorite national park, Pete?
Big Bend. In Texas?
Yeah, you like Big Bend, huh?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I don't know if it's, I guess it's not a national park, but I was just in San Francisco, and there's the Redwoods, I guess would be a national park, right? But I wasn't there. I was at the Carmel by the Sea and that area by like Pebble Beach where the golf.
Oh, yeah.
It was
beautiful.
So great. I'm not sure if it was, I don't think it was national parkland, though. It should be. It's probably protected.
Should be.
It probably is. Let's just say it is.
Done.
Done. But we'll talk about the national parks coming up at 9 o'clock. And then also tonight, Eric D. Johnson, also known as the Fruit Bats. Eric D. Johnson is a singer-songwriter who lives in Portland right now, but he's got a brand new record that everybody loves. He's going to be at Due Division this weekend. He used to be in the band The Shins. Eric is a great performer and a great musician. The Fruit Bats at the Due Division Street Festival. We'll talk with him coming up later in the program. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We come back. Be the carryout. Stay with us. All right, let's get this show on the road, shall we? Tonight, let's start with the carryout like we do every night. This, of course, is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Mayor Rahm Emanuel and his wine buddy, Governor Bruce Rauner, are sniffing at each other. Rahm essentially called Rauner Baby Trump, and Rauner called Rahm Baby Karen Lewis. I love that Karen Lewis is somehow equal to Donald Trump. Guys, I hope you can make up by, like, drinking a $100,000 bottle of champagne. You're too good of friends to let silly government get in the way. Hillary Clinton made a big foreign policy speech today and took aim at Donald Trump, saying he was a temperamentally unfit to be president of the most powerful country in the world. Trump quickly responded with, "Temperamentally unfit? I've got air conditioning." The Tribune Publishing Company has decided to rename itself. Tronc Incorporated is the new name. It's an acronym for Tribune Online Content. So that should tell you where the company is heading. In other words, if you have a bird and a bird cage, you may want to invest in a different type of lining. United Airlines is upping the ante on attracting international travelers. New business class pods will let you lie down, have some privacy, etc. But read the fine print. For every REM sleep cycle, they charge you an extra $50. I mean, it's an airline after all. McDonald's is eyeing the old Harpo space in the West Loop for their new corporate headquarters. This would happen in 2018. When asked for comment, Oprah was like, "Will it have a drive-through?" No word if it's going to have a drive-through. Yesterday, Tom Ricketts talked to the Lakeview Chamber of Commerce, saying that his Piazza idea could be the same as castles in Europe, just with more Ronnie Woo-Woo. Alderman Tunney responded today saying that the Cubs are calling it a piazza, but it's just a fancy word for beer garden. If approved, it would be 20 times bigger than any other outdoor patio in the city. One outdoor patio to rule them all. Think about how many buckets of Bud Lights that is. Rolling Stone is reporting that Blake Shelton, Ariana Grande, and Drake are all claiming to have the number one album this week. Yep, they all sent out releases saying they were number one. See, I told you this everyone gets a trophy for participating movement was going to bite us in the ass. You guys, you're all winners. Now, who wants juice? Drake, I know you love juice. In weather, summertime shy. We're here. Which reminds me, I need to get some new flippy floppies. In sports, Kyle the Calculator Hendricks shined bright today on the mound at Wrigley. The Cubs beat the Dodgers to take 3-4 in that series. They beat up on the new 19-year-old Dodger pitcher Julio Urias. And Chris Bryant hit a towering homer that hit the scoreboard, which in the past would have been a homer onto Waveland Avenue, so thanks for ruining that scoreboard. The Sox start a new series in Detroit tomorrow night. Big one there. They can't afford to lose any more ground in the division. The NBA Finals start tonight. Steph Curry, Draymond Green, Kevin Love, LeBron James, Kyrie Irving, Klay Thompson, the other guys. It's a list of who's who in the NBA. I mean, but still, I mean, it's Oakland versus Cleveland. I mean, what do the Mayors bet? Oakland cheese, Cleveland water. What is it? The Bears tried out former first-round pick Jake Long today. He's an offensive lineman. I hope he signs so we can start working on the posters. Kyle and Jake, first and long. Kyle and Jake, long arms of the law. Kyle and Jake, we got the same last name, but we're not related. Maybe needs to be workshopped a little bit. And finally tonight, a new study says that dads who yell at their kids end up having more aggressive teenagers. Well, maybe if you'd put the milk away like I asked. Well, that's the carryout for June 2nd, 2016. Hey, did you order coffee? It's after 7 o'clock. I'm not making another pod. Just drink a Coke like everybody else. Coming up, we're going to talk with former SNL cast member Tim Meadows. He's hosting the NBC Second City Breakout Festival at Second City this weekend, so we'll talk to him about his illustrious career and much more. Stay tuned. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. All right, more to come here on The Download. Tim Meadows coming up after the news. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
Man, if I were any better, I'd be a balanced state budget. Got to tell you.
You've got a whole – Rob's working on a new book. It's a bunch of quick-witted jokes about state government.
Crappy news-related one-liners by Rab.
I would write a blurb for that. Rob Martier knows the news better than anybody else.
You know, it's funny because sometimes, and I know our listeners appreciate this, you know, we get into this kind of redundancy, mm-hmm. you know, on particular stories, and we're always searching for something to kind of jazz it up a little bit. This whole budget thing, there's really not much to jazz it up with.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's always strange, too, to that there's really this kind of like air right now of, all right, well, we got through the spring session. Let's take a break. It's vacation time. You know what? Let's take a deep breath. We're lawmakers. We did so much. And you're like, okay, get back down there.
You know how you know when Rauner's really mad at Rom is when he sends him a Chardonnay as opposed to a Pinot Grigio? Because he knows Rom doesn't like Chardonnay.
He knows, and Rom gets furious.
Done.
How many times I got to tell you I don't drink Chardonnay?
You're out of the wine club.
You're out. Give back your retainer, your $100,000 retainer.
Right.
You're out of the wine club.
Yeah.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this weekend, the Second City NBC Universal Breakout Comedy Festival takes place in Old Town. The festival was created last year with the goal of showcasing diverse voices in comedy. Some standouts who have been on this show before will be featured: Thelonious Monk, Sonia Denise, the Defiant Thomas Brothers, just to name a few. The host of the festival, none other than SNL alum and star Tim Meadows. Meadows, of course, was a star at Second City before he moved to Saturday Night Live. Meadows has had an amazing career in both TV and film. He's currently starring in Bob's Burgers on Fox, and he's in the new movie Pop Star, Never Stop Stopping, starring the Lonely Island guys. He's also got a new show coming out on Fox in the fall called Son of Zorn. But the best part about Tim Meadows, when he's not on set or making us laugh on the coast, he's right here in the Chicago area popping in for improv shows like he did back in the day. It's an honor to welcome Tim Meadows to The Download. Thanks for being here, Mr. Meadows.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk, why come back to host this festival?
Well, they asked me, first of all, and I guess they knew that I do stand-up now. I've been touring the country for the past 5 years or so doing stand-up. So, they asked me if I would be interested in emceeing this comedy festival, and they told me what it was about and everything, and I thought, yeah, it sounds like it'd be fun.
Well, I mean, obviously, lending your name to the festival gives it a lot of star power, because these are a lot of up-and-coming artists who are coming up and, you know, want to get in front of NBC and showcases. When you think about that, does it harken you back to the days when you were looking for a space and you were at Second City and you wanted to get in front of some of the producers from places like NBC?
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, it's just weird how time has changed over the years. You know, a friend of mine who does improv, Dave Pasquese, he does improv here in Chicago. He's a really great actor. And I saw him in an interview one time, and he said that back when we were doing improv, it was literally a road to nowhere. We were basically doing it just for the love of doing it. And, you know, you had people like SNL or, you know, people would come by to see the shows and cast from those casts. But there was no guarantee that was going to happen, you know. And so now it's nice to see that a lot of people come to Chicago to cast their shows and see what talent is here.
How important is it to showcase diverse voices? This lineup is predominantly African-American. I mentioned, you know, Thelonious Monk and others, Dave Hellum, Defiant Thomas, Brother Seth Thomas, just to name a few. How important is it? Because, you know, in the past, Second City has been a place that has been predominantly white in its casts and ensembles. I mean, notable exceptions. But talk about how important it is to showcase diversity, especially diverse voices from Chicago.
I think it's important. You know, I mean, I think it's important that you give everybody gets a chance, you know. I don't know if these performers would have this opportunity if it wasn't created for them, you know. one of the things about doing improv and stand up in Chicago is that there's like a lot of small clubs and places that you can go and perform. And so you have a good opportunity to get better here without being, you know, seen nationally. Like in LA, you know, you get cast pretty quick there. You know, I don't think you get enough time to like develop your art. And I think being here in Chicago, you get more time to develop. And I think for these performers, I think, you know, this is not a good opportunity for them to showcase their talent in front of larger audiences and more diverse crowds. So
do you think that helped you, that time in Chicago, you know, before going to SNL, did that help you that you had some time to be on stage at Second City to work on your craft?
Yeah, it did. I mean, it gave me the time that I had in Chicago gave me the opportunity to develop a work ethic and to develop you sort of learn that to make sacrifices for the stuff that you want to do, you know. I was broke for a long time in Chicago. you work at crappy jobs just to make ends meet. But, you know, I had my evenings were free to do improv. And I remember right before I got hired at SNL, I was performing at Second City 6 nights a week. And then on the 7th night, I would go and do Improv Olympic.
Yeah, right.
And so during that time, I was on stage every night of the week. So when they came to see me, I was on fire. I was just like fine tuned, you know. So, yeah, you know, it was good for me.
Being the star that you are and the, you know, thousands and thousands of comedians that you've worked with, do you recognize a difference from people who came through Chicago and maybe some people who just went straight to L.A. or maybe came up in New York? Is the work ethic that maybe sets people apart?
I don't know if it's any different. I just think that in Chicago, there's less of a spotlight on you, you know, so you just... The drive is different. Like the drive in Chicago is just to get better and to get on bigger stages, you know, whereas the drive for you in LA is to get a sitcom or get a movie or be seen by casting directors or whatever. So I don't know. I think that's kind of like the big difference as I see it.
You spend a lot of time in Los Angeles because of the industry, obviously. Mm-hmm. There's been a big push to move industry back to the Midwest. We see it with Dick Wolf's shows and the other stuff that's happening here in Chicago that's shooting from Empire and other shows. As someone who lives here in Chicago and has also had success on the coast, do you see that firsthand? Do you see more and more production coming back to Chicago and that might be a good thing for people like you?
I mean, I think it's a good thing for Chicago and for actors in Chicago to have these shows that come here and, produce their shows here, because you can get cast in these shows, even if it's just for one episode, and you sort of learn how things are done, you know? So, yeah, I mean, that's how I said, I think it's good. But in general, I mean, I think the industry now, I mean, I think it goes wherever the tax breaks, you know,
right.
are, you know? So, I mean, I've worked from anywhere from Nova Scotia to Toronto to Vancouver to Atlanta. I've worked in Baton Rouge in Louisiana. I've been all over the place shooting different TV shows and movies, you know, it makes it easier for me to live in Chicago because I don't necessarily have to be in LA all the time for
right.
work.
Let me ask you, you know, we've had actors on and stage actors, Broadway stars who've talked about the way that their schedules are, meaning that they're going to be on top of the world for a 6-month run. Then essentially they're unemployed and they have to look for another job. It's mm-hmm. similar with you. I mean, obviously with being in film and television, having success in both areas, you have relationships and you can work. But it really, I mean, hearing you talk about the different places that you've been, I mean, your life is this idea of like a 3-month job to a 2-month job to a 6-month job. Do you like that lifestyle? I mean, is that something, obviously you've had your entire life, but is that something that, you know, adds stress, or is it something that you've done a good job of compartmentalizing?
That's a good question. My therapist would say that I've done a good job of compartmentalizing it because there are stretches where I'm like, I gotta get a job, you know? And that's one of the great things about being able to do stand up now is that I don't worry as much in between those 3-month jobs, you know, because I go, well, I'll just go and perform now. I'll just tour and do stand-up until the next job comes up, you know. So there used to be a lot more, you know, anxiety about not working, but I found like just being able to do stand-up has just made that transition period a lot easier.
Do you like doing stand-up? I mean, you came up in improv and sketch comedy, and I read an article about how you made that transition waiting for Joe and Brad to get to the show. But do you like the idea of stand-up? I mean, what are the differences between stand-up and your past life in improv and sketch?
I do. I love everything about stand-up except the flying, the traveling, being in different cities. The thing I love about stand-up is the moment I walk on stage and do my show. And then when it's over, I don't like anything else about it. You know, like the only thing I really love is the performing aspect of it. So, yeah, I mean, I do like it. And it was a hard transition to make in some aspects of going from performing with a group of people to performing by myself. But like with, you know, just from the training that I've got with Second City and SNL and everything else is like, you just learn to do the job and you just focus on the thing that you're going to do and you get it done.
Tim, what do you got coming up? I mean, I mentioned in the intro, Son of Zorn. I mean, that's exciting for you because it's getting back into TV in a regular, you know, starring role. Talk about Son of Zorn.
Well, Son of Zorn is it's a new show coming from Fox in the fall, and it's animated and real life characters. Zorn is the main character, and he's animated, and he's voiced by Jason Sudeikis. And it's a hybrid show. It's like, the best way to describe it is like sort of like what Roger Rabbit was, but it's a basic family sitcom. It's like, it's really fun to do. It's different.
Are you acting or are you animated?
I'm acting. Yeah, I'm a live character in it. I play the fiance of Zorn's ex-wife.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's, you know, it's like a complicated show to explain. I always tell my friends now, like, just go watch the commercial on YouTube and you'll see what the show is all about.
There you go.
Because it's so hard to explain.
Got it. Son of Zorn will be out this fall. You know, he's currently the mailman on Bob's Burgers on Fox. He's in the new movie Pop Star Never Stop Stopping. Tim Meadows will be hosting the Second City NBC Universal Breakout Comedy Festival this weekend at Second City here in Chicago. Tim Meadows, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
No problem. Nice talking to you.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, big table, Jim May, professional storyteller, his new book, Trail Guide for a Crooked Heart, Stories and Reflections for Life Journeys. Jim's been a tremendous storyteller in this area for, I would say, I think it's about 30 years. So we'll talk with Jim about his career, about storytelling as we know it. He's done tremendous work researching storytelling. And we'll talk about his new book and maybe hear a story or two. What do you think of that? Tim Meadows, how about that? Were you a Tim Meadows guy?
Yeah, of course.
He's so funny. And it is fun to know that he still lives in the area.
Yeah.
You know?
It's great.
It kind of makes you feel good about Chicago.
Yeah, it does.
It's such a weird thing. Oh, Tim Meadows lives here? Great. I love this town.
I get that. I feel the same way.
I got to wait an hour and a half in this line for emissions test? That doesn't matter. Tim Meadows lives here. yeah, I got a nice, I'm going to pull up the text here. 312 said, very much understand your frustrations about your recent experiences at the Illinois emissions testing stations. I work very close to an emission station at the Waukegan-Gurnee border. The traffic jams were just horrible for the last week and a half. This was not only a nightmare for nearby homeowners, but a costly pain for the businesses. Companies could not receive products and had difficulty shipping products. Trucks could not get to the loading docks because of all the cars.
Ah.
The Gurnee police did a good job the last few days getting it under control. Then it says, is there a way to get someone from the Illinois EPA and the Secretary of State's office on because there was no coordination between them. Huh. Is this a continuing problem? Thanks. It's a good idea for
segment. Yeah, it is.
Although I called while I was in line. I called the Secretary of State's office, right, the central office. I Googled it because I wanted to know if I could possibly just go do it without the emissions test.
Yeah.
Nobody answered.
Nobody answered?
Nobody answered. Like, to get to the point where you're like, would you like to talk to an operator? Press 3. You press 3, and I did it probably 10 times because I was in that line for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And nobody ever answered the phone.
They're all just sitting around looking at him ringing.
Well, I realized.
I know what this is about.
Yeah, there were probably 5 or 6 listings for Secretary of State's offices, you know, like a little express, express one down on Randolph, whatever. So I kept going to the different sites and be like, well, I'll call this one. It was the same number. So there's one circular number for the office that just rings to nowhere. They put that phone in the base budget cuts. They put that phone in the basement. The last thing we're doing is talking to people, the people that we serve. So, yeah, I don't know. And I've heard that the Secretary of State's office has said, ain't our problem. Illinois EPA's problem.
Yeah, EPA.
So they're kind of what I like to call round or ramen it, just blaming each other for this melee. And if you're joining the conversation late on this, we are complaining about if you had to get an emissions test in the last month, essentially, maybe in the last 2 weeks, before you can get a new license plate sticker in the state of Illinois, you were met with hours long lines at the different emissions testing place because there was a mess up because of the budget stalemate where I don't really understand it completely, but they just weren't sending out the notices.
Yeah.
And then they started to send it out saying, okay, we're going to ramp it back up now that we got some cash. Now that I don't know what happened. Something was released, and they're like, good, now we can get some stamps on these notices.
All sitting there.
And so everybody at the last minute is like, oh, I got to get this done before I can get a new sticker. So, like, pretty much the state of Illinois all went to the emissions test on May 31st. So pretty bad. Bad experience, not good for efficiency for state government, not a good way to end a tenure at the Secretary of State's office for Jesse White. Like I said yesterday, I'll try not to take this out on the Tumblr. I'm going to try not. I'm trying. I know the kids did nothing wrong. They're just working on their flips. They're acrobatics, you know? So yeah. Got to separate. He separates politics and tumbling. So can I.
All right. I know.
Right.
Work through it.
I'll work through it. All right, so coming up, we're going to talk with Jim May. A little bit later, Dave Schwann's going to talk about the National Park Service series he's had here on WGN Radio. Very interesting about the sort of origins and background stories of the national parks, especially in the Midwest. And then we're going to talk with Eric D. Johnson, who is Fruit Bats.
Mm-hmm.
Great band that is playing at Dew Division Fest this weekend.
Yeah, festival season.
224 says you should go to the Crystal Lake testing station. It's always empty.
You tried.
I tried that. Not necessarily Crystal Lake, but I took that. I had that same thought, 224. I'm like, there's no way. That one's always empty out there. No.
Yeah, just head down to Carbondale. It's all right. No one's ever at that one.
Someone yesterday called it out with the idling. We did more damage to the environment by waiting in line to get our emissions tested. But I always, I think about the miles, you know, if you think about, you know, your idling, so not necessarily miles that were driven, but you think about that. And I think about, you know, going out to Addison, like I did, thinking I was smarter than everybody else and then running into traffic there. I mean, I probably spent $35 to $50 in gas and time, the way I was kind of equating it.
At least.
For
the amount of time that you spend, for sure, be doing something else.
I hope somebody writes a book about this, about my pain for sitting in an hour and a half line. Like, it's just like, almost like Eric Kleinenberg, who writes all those books, who did the Heat Wave, some other books. I hope, like, a historian, a cultural or anthropology historian, like anthropologist.
We'll be talking about this for years come, I'm sure.
The 2016 emissions snap gate.
Yeah.
You do realize those listening online in Venezuela are rolling their eyes right now.
Yeah, right. It truly is first world problems. It truly is.
I don't blame you, though.
And to all those listeners from Venezuela, hola. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a part of WGN and the download. Okay, so 847 says, Justin, my friend called me from the Crystal Lake emissions testing on 531, and she waited 3 to 4 hours in line. So there you go. So that I did. That's exactly what I thought, Rob. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go out to Addison. Ain't nobody going to be in Addison. I'm going to go out to Crystal Lake. Then, oh, man, I'll just fly right on 90. I get to Crystal Lake. Nobody will be there. I'll make up the time difference by driving. You know, wind in the hair kind of thing.
They have cars there, too, you know.
Yeah. Unbelievable. I mean, I think we're onto something. I don't hear – I mean, it kind of was a little bit of a story yesterday, and then it was like, all right, it's over.
Wait, because I do marketing part-time on the side, we could actually make this like a giveaway. You get to usurp the line at the emissions testing place.
Right.
We're giving away pole position.
To the 91st caller, right?
That's right.
We got a deal with Antonio, who works at the emissions testing out in Elk Grove Village. He will skip you. He'll get you ahead of the line.
Slip them a couple of C notes.
And then that's a prize we're giving here on WGN Radio. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Dave Schwann's going to be here from WGN Radio to talk about his series he just put out on the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. He just did the three-part series about, I think it was a little bit more. I actually listened to it online, so it was all bunched together, but I think he was doing it all week on the Midwest National Parks. He goes to each one, and he talks to the different park rangers. But we'll talk to Dave about what makes what the history of the national parks in the area and also what makes a great national park. And we'll take your calls, 312-981-7200. Also coming up, Eric D. Johnson from – or I want to say – I always want to say Eric D. Johnson from Fruit Bats, but he is Fruit Bats. That's so his new record, Absolute Loser, is blowing up. It's getting rave reviews everywhere you look. He's going to be headlining at Due Division Fest this weekend. He's going to join us later in the show. Well, growing up in Spring Grove, Illinois, Jim May didn't know much about the art of storytelling. As a matter of fact, his early jobs were in construction. He did some teaching, some counseling. But over the years, May became fascinating with telling stories. He collected them. He learned from them. He took them with him, touring across the country, performing at the National Storytelling Festival, and even brought the stories home to Spring Grove, starting the Illinois Storytelling Festival, which ran for 25 years. Jim May has a new book out. He's the author of The Trail Guide for a Crooked Heart, Stories and Reflections for Life's Journeys. He's also the author of The Farm on Nipissing Creek, Stories from a Midwestern Childhood. You can see Jim regularly performing in McHenry County at the Woodstock Opera House, and he is my guest tonight at the big table. Jim May, good to see you.
Hey, it's great to be here, Justin.
All right, so let's talk about the new book, Trail Guide for a Crooked Heart. Why? Tell me about the book, because it's very interesting. I mean, it's anecdotes, it's stories that are put together, but it's about storytelling.
Yeah, it's all those things. It's a kind of an eclectic mixture. Years ago, I came upon a line of poetry from W.H. Auden that said, love your crooked neighbor with your crooked heart. And it rang sort of a bell. Because so many of the stories that I have been attracted to over the years are stories that are a little crooked. You know, they talk about how life's path is always not exactly what you expect. You know, John Lennon said, life is what happens to us when we're making other plans.
Right.
You know? And, you know, these characters in mythology, and George Lucas made great use of this. You remember the bar scene with all those strange characters,
right.
You know, unexpected, paradoxical characters. You know, it's the greatest mentors of Luke were Yoda and Obi-Wan. Obi-Wan's kind of the classic, you know, grandfatherly,
right.
Wizened. But Yoda, you know, does he look like a warrior, master, Jedi teacher? No, he looks like a cross between a mushroom and a beagle, you know. That's paradox. That's like teaching us to look at life kind of crooked. Paradox takes us deeper into the meaning of life, into the mystery of it. So when I heard that, love your crooked neighbor with your crooked heart, you start out admitting that you're crooked, admitting that you're, flawed, and that just might lead you to more interesting insights and deeper into the mystery of life. And if
yeah.
you do everything straight, you know. So that's kind of where the title and the theme of the book came from, really. All the stories kind of crowd around that.
Jim, would you consider this a book, a collection of stories, or would you consider this almost a book of philosophy?
I would hope it's all those things. You know, another thing that I expanded on the book is I worked one time and hired for our Illinois Storytelling Festival a shaman and storyteller from the Nootka tribe, which is a First Nation tribe of Vancouver Island. His name was Johnny Moses. He's still out there telling stories. And he's also a shaman with that tribe. And one day he was talking and he said, in our tribe, mistakes are looked upon as windows for the soul to climb out of in order to grow bigger. And I say that's saved my psychic butt many times, you know. I was beating on myself for something stupid that I did and continue to do. But, you know, what a wonderful opening. What a wonderful way to approach failure and to pass on to the younger generation that, okay, you know, you make a mistake. We're not going to heap, disgrace upon you. How can this twist in your life, this crooked, you know, point in your life, open up to something, maybe a miracle, who knows, but at least you'll be able to get through it.
We're talking with Jim May. He's a professional storyteller. When I think of stories, obviously everything from film, television, like you mentioned, Star Wars, to the NBA Finals, to everything in between, to musicians, everything is based in a story. Everything, even tonight, we're telling the story of Jim May.
Right.
But what storytelling usually really excels at for me is that transformative moment, the moment where it becomes less about the story and the characters and more about the lesson. Do I have that right? I mean, because I don't want it to be, I don't want to characterize it as hit over the head, like, and remember, you know, always make your bed.
Right.
You know,
right.
But the point being that there are transformative qualities in the stories that are in Trail Guide for a Crooked Heart. It is spiritual. It is philosophical.
Right. Yeah. The stories, you know, some of the books on values are like this. They start at the end. They start with what they want you to learn. Then they kind of backtrack and the story is fairly lifeless, you know, but of a story that, you know, that moves and bends and the lesson could be different for every person that hears it. And think about these old fables and folk tales and myths, you know, all the way back to Sumerian myths were the first ones written down, but the Greek myths, the Roman myths, you know, these survive for centuries because before they were able to have been written down, there was no written language. Mm-hmm. Before humanity was literate, they survived because they were necessary for the survival of the tribe. They weren't bedtime stories. They were that too, but they were passed down from elder to elder. Sometimes these were formal, griots in the African tradition or Shawnakis in the Irish tradition. But often they were just part of the fabric of the community. You know, everybody knew that story. There's a story that maybe I'll tell in a little bit that in China goes back to an ancient dynasty. But if you have a great tragedy in your life or a great piece of luck in your life, someone's liable to come up to you and say, I heard your horse ran off. And everyone knows the story. It's like here we say, the boy who cried wolf.
Right.
Don't cry wolf. So, you know, we live in narrative. We accumulate narrative over the centuries to guide us in our living.
Mm-hmm.
And then we tell stories about our own experience.
Well, let's take a quick break. But I think what I really want to get at in the big table is that concept of, you know, these are folk tales and how much is 2016 aiding or taking away from the art of storytelling. You can go to every corner here in Chicago on Tuesday night, Thursday night in the back of the bar, and there'll be 17 storytellers ready to wow the audience and entertain them. And it's electric. But is that good or bad for the basic element of folk tales, the idea of, you know, being able to pass on from generation to generation the stories of humankind? Jim May is the author of Trail Guide for a Crooked Heart. We'll continue our conversation here at the big table right after this. Here's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest at the big table tonight, Jim May. He's the author of Trail Guide for a Crooked Heart. He's a storyteller. He tells folk tales. He teaches workshops. He's everywhere. He's from Spring Grove, Illinois. He lives in McHenry County. You can see him regularly telling stories at the Woodstock Opera House on the square. Jim, good to see you. Thanks for being here. Okay, so we left the conversation before the break just about folk tales and the concept of you know, I guess, you know, the difference between what you do in telling folk tales and the concept of moving or telling stories from generation to generation to keep the stories alive. And what we're seeing here in Chicago and other places of this sort of boom with the shows like The Moth, shows where everybody's telling their story.
their own personal experience story. Yeah, well, we were talking on the break here. You know, there's the story, there's sort of the event, and you tell what happened. Then there's the storyteller, there's a listener, and often each person in the audience is learning different from the story or is connecting emotionally.
Right.
And a good story is connecting emotionally with what the storyteller is saying. It's sort of like there's three stories going on. There's the story the storyteller is telling. There's the storyteller's life, which sometimes shows through and sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they talk about. And there's a story that is going through the audience. Each member of the audience is through their head, and they're kind of lining up the story they're hearing with their own life. But, you know, so we had talked about, you know, happenings. Okay, so like if, you know, that cougar that showed up at the 7-Eleven a couple of years ago.
Yeah, the coyote.
Yeah, or coyote. Let's make it a cougar. It's more fun. You know, that storytelling liberty or storytelling.
First rule of storytelling.
Yes.
Make a coyote
don't
a cougar.
Know, sometimes you have to change the truth to make it more true. And that we could talk all night about
that.
So a cougar jumps through the glass here on Michigan Avenue, grabs Justin Coughlin by the head, drags him around, you know, the hallowed halls of GN here. And Justin, you know, with his comedic timing and his insight and his naturally lovable personality, soothes the wild beast and survives to tell the tale. Well, that story would probably win a moth, you know, talk off somewhere. So, and it should, you know, because we need...
My wounds may never heal, but it would be a great moth story.
We all need to share, you know, this journey and this trial through life. Now, people in my community, most of the people that are out there on Tuesday nights and Thursday nights are not professional. They're not making a living telling stories. Those of us who have taken it on as a life's work... it's sort of like we have taken the story, you know, and it's like a plant, and we've taken like the deep roots of it. You know, we've studied it for years, and this kind of deep taproot goes down, and you find out that it goes down, goes back to centuries, and it goes, it includes personal experience stories, but also includes, you know, these old tales that have been preserved before there was even an ability to write them down, because the stories were so important to the survival of the tribe or the community. I met a fellow by the name of Dr. Wolfram, who's a folklorist from the island of Tonga at a Pacific conference of storytellers in Honolulu. And he got up and he said, the old tales were very important to my people. They kept us from eating our grandchildren. Well, the Brothers Grimm, there's a story called The Juniper Tree, where the stepmother cuts up the father's son and feeds him in a stew. That actually has a happy ending.
sure.
Spoiler alert. But anyways, I thought, what's a nice metaphor? Keeps us from eating our grandchildren. Because, you know, in some ways, all families kind of eat their children. They kind of consume what they can to a lesser or greater extent. We try not to. I thought, what's a nice metaphor? But then when I started doing some research on Tonga, they were cannibal at a certain time in their history. So he might have been speaking metaphorically as well as literal.
Maybe metaphorical, maybe literal.
Right. But you know, we live in narrative. We accumulate this narrative over the centuries, and it guides us. And every spiritual tradition is guided
by
that.
Well, let's hear a story. I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but let's hear a story before we go to the news. So we can get an understanding of some of the stories. Do you have one that's not a personal story, one that is more of a generation?
Yeah, this is one I've been telling for a long time. And actually, I used it when I was a counselor at McHenry County College. And it struck the students so, and they came back to me that it opened some doors for me.
Right.
It's an old Chinese story about an old man and his one son. And they have one horse, and they farm this little rice paddy. And they toil, you know, every day assiduously. And at the end of the year, they have enough rice to put away for seed, enough to eat, and a little bit to barter in town, maybe, you know, tea, sugar, maybe some new harness for the horse. And that's it. And they start over again every year. Well, one day, the horse ran off. And the neighbor comes to the old man, and son said, well, what are you going to do? You're ruined. You're going to starve to death. How can you farm without a horse? And the old man says, I do not know if this is good or this is bad. Well, the horse comes back in a couple of weeks with a wild mate. The neighbor said, you've doubled your wealth. Now you can borrow some money from the landlord. You can buy some more seed, rent a little more land. This time you'll have enough to sell, finally, and save that gold you get. Pretty soon you can do that each year, and pretty soon you'll be a wealthy man. old man says, I don't know if this is good or this is bad. Well, the wild horse, you know, doesn't, I guess, objects to, be, to being giving up his feral life and becoming a beast of burden, you know, ends up crippling the son. He kicks him or throws him. And the old man sits up, you know, night after night with the son writhing in pain on the mat there. And the neighbor comes over and sometimes sits with him. And the old man has tears coming down, looks at his neighbor and says, even this, I do not know if it's good or bad. Well, at the end of the story, a warlord has amassed a superior army at the province border. All the young men are drafted off to face certain death. It's a given. But they have to do it because of honor. And the neighbor says goodbye to his sons, and he knows he'll never see them again. And he comes to the old man, whose son is still there because he has a limp and he's crooked. He's crooked, see? But he still can help at the farm, but he doesn't have to go to war. And the neighbor says, how lucky you are to have your son in your old age. And the old man says, I do not know if this is good or bad. And they say in China today, even though it's an ancient story, if you have a great piece of luck or a great tragedy in your life, someone's allowed to come up in the street who knows you and say, I heard your horse ran off. Now, in the movie Charlie Wilson's War, which is about our involvement in Afghanistan, when we funded the Mujahideen against the Russians, Charlie Wilson, the congressman from Texas, and the CIA, they colluded to make this, the fund, the Mujahideen, with advanced weapons and so forth. And Philip Seymour Hoffman is the CIA operative. Tom Hanks is Charlie Wilson, the swashbuckling guy, you know. So throughout the movie, Philip Seymour Hoffman, the CIA op, says, you know, I got a funny feeling about this thing in Afghanistan. Did I ever tell you that Zen story? And Charlie Wilson, Tom Hanks, says, we don't have time for that. We're beating the Russians. You know, come on, we don't have time for a story. And they go on and on two or three times. Did I ever tell you about that Zen story? I don't have time for that. Finally, after three or four attempts, by the end of the movie, when they do defeat the Russians, Tom Hanks, the Charlie Wilson congressman, actor who's playing the congressman, you know, they're raising a drink. They're toasting because the Mujahideen has driven the Russians out. And Philip Seymour Hoffman says, now, can I tell you that story?
Yeah.
And tell me the damn story. And the story he tells is the story I just told you. I don't know if it's good or bad. Although he says his refrain is, we'll see. Each time the old man says, we'll see. Well, the we'll see of funding the Mujahideen and beating the Russians was 9/11.
Right. The precursor to everything that's happening.
Yeah, Mujahideen became Al-Qaeda. And so, you know, there's this, if you apply that standard, you know, the things that happen to you, is this
good
or bad? It's almost
I cannot tell.
Never one or the other.
Yeah.
And that's an ancient, you know, piece of wisdom that, and so students would come back to me at the college and say, you know, I had a car wreck, I had dropped out of school, I ran out of money, and I thought my life was over. But I remember that story you told about, maybe this isn't good, maybe it's not good, maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. And it really, it became one of the biggest counseling tools I had. And same with me. I mean, again, it saves my psychic butt about once a week, you know, like, I can give you an example. But anyways, that's one of those ancient healing stories that healed people way before the pseudoscience of psychology.
The author is Jim Mays, the author of The Trail Guide for a Crooked Heart, Stories and Reflections for Life Journeys. Let's take a break for the news, get an update on tonight's news, and we'll continue our conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Jim May, professional storyteller. His new book, Trail Guide for a Crooked Heart, is out, Stories and Reflections for Life's Journeys. He's a professional storyteller, grew up here in McHenry County, still lives in McHenry County. You can see him regularly performing at the Woodstock Opera House. Jim, talk about how did you get involved in storytelling? Because I kind of at the beginning teased out that you had a fascination around it, but I mean, you were in construction jobs. I mean, you were kind of as far from the arts as you possibly could be.
Well, before I talk about that, you mentioned McHenry County. Do you remember the first time you ever interviewed me?
No. We're old friends.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
But okay. What was you were about? 10. You were in fourth grade. Every year we'd come over to your house, have a big Christmas party, and everyone else is like singing carols and doing Christmas stuff. You're running around with a tape recorder interviewing everybody. It's you know, there's a.
I feel like that was an assignment of some sort.
Really?
Like someone assigned
me to
do
that. No, I remember.
No, I wanted to be a basketball player. I wanted to be. No, I.
Well, the two left feet got in the way of that, probably.
But you have had such a presence in storytelling. I mean, think about it. I mean, talk about right there at 10 years old. I mean, that's three decades or so in
right,
storytelling.
Yeah, I've been on the road about 35 years.
So talk about it. Talk about the point where, you know, you turn towards this art form, not just the art form, but start to learn more about it.
Well, actually, you know, I just thought of something. Bringing up you, you know, there's a James Hillman, who's considered the father of archetypal psychology. He has a whole book called The Soul's Code, and he maintains that we're born with a code. It's like this old African idea and typical traditional idea. You're born with a destiny, and your job is to find out what that destiny is, you know. And in some ways, I think I was always looking for something, you know. I messed around with photography. I love teaching. I thought I could someday write, but I wasn't writing anything except I won a contest in fifth grade or something. But a friend of mine, a teacher friend of mine, we were always looking for things to get our kids excited. I taught fifth grade for 10 years, and I got him interested in bird watching. I'm a bird watcher. Actually, we call ourselves birders because it sounds more masculine. But anyways, he went crazy on bird watching, got a degree in outdoor education, became teacher of the year, conservation teacher of the year. But he was coming back from a sabbatical at the Okefenokee Swamp in 1977 or 8. And he was coming through the Smoky Mountains, and he saw near Jonesboro, Tennessee, the oldest town in Tennessee, a sign says storytelling. It was like on a board, you know, on a piece of plywood and an arrow. Well, John and his wife went to Knox College. I've never met anyone from Knox College that wasn't intellectually curious. So they just followed the arrow. And it was this oldest town in Tennessee, cobblestone streets. You know, Andrew Jackson used to practice law there, had the first abolition press, you know, real mountain, fierce mountain people, fiercely independent. And they were bringing storytellers from the mountains who spoke in Elizabethan dialects. They brought a storyteller from a tribe, a Chippewa Cree, Ron Evans from Canada, and they were basically sitting on French front porches and church basements telling these stories. It was like a music concert, except all these little venues around town were story venues. And John said, it was amazing, and I'm going to go back next year, and you should come with me. We'll learn some stories to tell our kids. And I thought, storytelling? Sounds weird. I didn't go. The following spring, he said, Jim, I have a ticket, extra ticket, to come down to Effingham, Illinois, to witness the ancient breeding ritual of the greater Illinois prairie chicken. Well, I packed my bags immediately.
You're there, right?
Yeah, I was there.
That one you're into.
And I can, that's the whole story, but these little prairie chickens, the males, you know, do this little courtship thing, and they pounce on each other, and we got to record from the blind what was going on, and record the number of birds, the difference between a successful and unsuccessful mating of the greater Illinois prairie chicken. Can I say this?
You're so wealthy with knowledge, Jim.
Okay, so well, there's two distinctions. One is about 3 seconds. 3 seconds. Just be glad you're not a prairie chicken. The other is, after a successful mating, the hen disengages, walks about 3 yards, and goes, bah! Successful mating. Okay, so John and I are talking about this weeks later, and he said, you know, two of the best things I've done educationally or art-wise or anything, really, they both happened in the last 18 months or so. I said, really? What were they? He said, well, one was that prairie chicken. I'm like, well, yeah.
Yeah, right.
He said, the other was storytelling. And he said it just like that, storytelling, like it was a concept, like it was a phenomenon, which it is. And I thought, well, if storytelling can exist in the rarefied air of those hormonally gifted prairie chickens that I wanted in, right? So I went down the next year. We dismissed our kids on a Columbus weekend, and we drove all the way down in a VW bus and a Freakmobile.
Let me ask you, Jim.
I heard my first story, and I was hooked. Came back and told my fifth graders, and they looked at me like, this guy's more interesting than he was last Friday afternoon. So that was the beginning.
You know, I always think about storytelling, and I think about it as almost a rites of passage, in a way, that elders would pass on stories to other generations, and it really did sort of come from elders. Like it was the shaman, you mentioned the shaman or someone, the elder statesman in the tribe, mm-hmm. and they were almost, their job as they got to an elder state was to tell the stories of their tribe.
Right.
And I guess you see that a little bit in the way that pop culture is kind of sort of embraced or explain the storyteller. You see it with people like Studs Terkel or Spalding Gray is another one, Garrison Keillor.
Right.
And but these are older, this is an older generation of from storytellers. Do you see that too, where there are more elders involved in storytelling? And how do you actually get that to pass on to the next generation?
Well, that's a very important question, and there's not a pad answer for it. But it's true. I sought out a storyteller by the name of Duncan Williamson, who was one of the traveling people of Scotland, claimed to know 3,000 stories and anecdotes and ballads. No one knows for sure because he's a storyteller. But 1,500 are in the archives of the School of Scottish Studies, and he was considered the greatest living teller in his day. In the Scots, Cant dialect, which is a traveler dialect, and English. And I spent hours and hours and days sitting next to a fire with him, you know. And he was just such an incredible mentor for me. I met an old woman, this is all in the book too, who knew the last queen of Hawaii, Inez Ashdown. She knew Queen Liliuokalani and told me a story about the queen. A story how the queen used this ancient Hawaiian myth to help Inez, because she knew Inez's parents were getting divorced. It's a wonderful story. So the young people that are telling stories, they are so important to the storytelling community because they are the next generation. And they are coming from their own experience, from their own hurts and betrayals and experiences and joys. But we, I think, my generation, we want to be a mentor to that group. And Scott Whitehair has the
Scott, yeah.
This Much Is True over on Lincoln Avenue on Tuesday.
He's a big-time storyteller.
Well, he came out to my workshop that
I
do.
So I was going to ask, are they reaching out to the elders, to the professionals to say, and when they do, are they interested in the way that what you've sort of researched in your life? Are they interested in the art of storytelling?
I think Scott was amazed and very welcoming of the fact that he was learning out at the workshop I do in the summer at our home that there's this centuries-old tradition of these stories. You know, he was coming at it from this 10-minute story or maybe a one-person show about events in his life, but there's this whole tradition. You know, we all are and can stand on the shoulders people, you know, storytellers over the millennia who have put their experience, dreams, imaginings into an artistic framework and passed that on. And it's a rich trove of oral tradition, of wisdom, of spirituality, and it's what keeps us old guys going.
Well, I mean, I would love to hear another story.
Okay.
If you got one in you.
Yeah, sure.
Because I do enjoy the. I mean, we are on the radio. This is what we do. I want to hear the stories.
Yeah, you're a storyteller.
I may not be a storyteller, but I'm definitely trying to pull out the stories and the guests that are on the show. And so for me, I feel like it's similar, but it's always great to have people like you, Jim, and other people on who can tell the stories of their life anecdotally and be able to pass that on through an amplifier, through the blowtorch.
Okay, well, I'll tell another story, and I want to draw from my own experience this time rather than a folktale or a myth. In my book, there's a story called My Sister Diane, and it starts in the fall. Actually, it was Halloween 2002, and I get a phone call. That phone call no one wants to get, that my sister, closest to me in age, is terminally ill from pancreatic cancer. Just like that, phone call, and your life changes immediately. So I jumped right on a plane. She was living in Las Vegas at the time, and I'm in a plane thinking, how am I going to get through the next few days? I've had friends, acquaintances, not close family that have died prolonged deaths, and I always wanted to go. I tended to go visit them, but I never quite got around to it. You know, something slipped my mind or something else got too important, and then I would go to their funeral. And I know now I was just afraid. You know, what do you say to someone, you know, you're standing healthy alongside a friend, colleague, a loved one, and they're at the end, you know. It's sort of like, you know, the two of you have walked through life walking down a sunny street, having a nice conversation and maybe eating an ice cream cone, and a piano falls out of a fourth-story ledge, hits them and misses you completely. Or they're tied to a railroad track with a locomotive coming, and you're standing next to them with no way to release them from that. What kind of a conversation do you have? Well, at that moment, I remembered a story, a personal experience story from my friend Elizabeth Ellis, a storyteller from Dallas, that she was driving home across Oklahoma and past Fort Sill, where Geronimo was held until his death. Mm-hmm. And she thought about turning off, you know, taking the exit and going to see that place and kind of pay her respects. But she remembered hearing, now whether this is apocryphal or not, I'm not sure, that he paced back and forth in that cell for years and just wore a rut in the hard clay or maybe even sandstone, whatever it was. And she said it just broke her heart to think about it, and she didn't turn off. She said she just couldn't stand to look at that. Well, so when she got home, she said that she became kind of ashamed. And the line that stuck with me, and this is the power of language, she said, you know, if he had a look at it, I'm sorry, if he had a live it, I ought to be able to look at it. Right. And this is true of people in our lives who go through hard times, go through tragedy. If they have to live it and we care about them, we ought to be able to look at it. And that got me through that time with my sister. It got me started anyway. And once I got involved in the last days with a loved one, it's a great gift, and it becomes a sacred thing, and that's what I talk about more in the story. But interestingly enough, I was in the book, I also talk about, you know, in war, and what is it about the myth of war that we keep on thinking that it's going to have a good result? Somehow we're going to accomplish something by this result. And I came upon an article by a photographer named Ken Jarecki. In the first Iraq war, there was something called Hell's Highway, where hundreds of Iraqi soldiers, maybe thousands, and their vehicles were basically gridlocked to be like the Kennedy Expressway at 3:30. Yeah, right. Nobody was going anywhere, and the Allied planes, U.S. planes, and mostly U.S. planes, just strafed and strafed and bombed until there was nothing. There was just a ribbon of charred bodies and metal. Well, Jarecki was there, and he took a photograph of this Iraqi soldier, what was left of him, trying to climb out of the windshield of his truck. Windshield was gone, of course. The soldier looked just was crisp, but he still looked human. But if you can imagine a human with just a cinder face and bones, clutching the window, trying to pull himself out of that truck at the last minute. Well, Jarecki thought he'd take that photograph, send it back home, and maybe it would change people's idea about the Iraq war or maybe war in general. No one would publish it. Not one U.S. editor would publish that photo. It ended up being published in London and in France. No one else would touch it. He said when he in his statement about how discouraged he was about that happening, he said, If we're gonna make war and participate in war, right, we ought to be able to look at it. It was just very similar to what my friend Elizabeth had said. So, you know, I think in our personal experience stories, we get these threads of the human experience that we all experience in the present, not in ancient history, but stories are stories, and they're all part of this crazy experience, this crooked path that we all live, and they're everywhere. They're everywhere.
Jim, where are you going to be this summer? I mean, this is the festival circuit for you. So quickly tell us where you're going to be.
Okay, I'm going to be this weekend in Pittsburgh. I don't know if you're a clear night. Maybe they're listening in Pittsburgh.
Martyr loves Pittsburgh.
Called a program called Tales Under the Trees, I think. And I'll be doing a book signing out there. And then I'm going to be in Kansas City in July leading a master class at our National Storytelling Conference. I'm going to be at the Opera House September 16th doing a book signing party. Free cake.
Great.
Free cake.
Free cake. Good stuff. Good.
And also about every once a month at Stage Left Cafe of the Opera House right next door. In fact, November 5th, I'll be there with your dad. We're going to do a night. Lenny, we're going to do a night of Eugene V. Debs stories.
And
your dad is an expert on him.
I'll tell the one story that my dad told me, and then we got to wrap. But my dad would always tell me this story. And this was one that he would always tell me. So he loves storytelling as well. But he always, whenever something would go wrong, right? Something would go wrong. He'd go, there's a story of the old lady who went down in the snow, and she went down and she saw in the block of ice a snake. In the block of ice was a frozen snake. And she brought the snake in, and she unthawed the snake. She put the snake with a little blanket on it and put it near the fire and all that. And the snake, you know, put some milk out, and the snake started to drink the milk, and it started to nurse back to health. And then one day she put the milk out, and the snake, whack, bit him right in the hand. And she's like, oh, my God, why'd you do that? You're a poisonous snake. Why did you bite me in the hand? I'm going to die. And the snake said, lady, you knew I was a snake the day you brought me in.
It's that was ancient story. It's a Brer Rabbit, Brer Snake, and Brer Possum.
I'm doing the radio of edit version. My dad would pull that one out, Jim. He would just pull and then another thing.
Yeah,
you know, and he'd be like, I know where this is going. He told a story.
Well, Lenny needs his own radio show.
He really does. All right.
I want to say one more thing. I've always been inspired by Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. You know, Tom Wolfe did a book called The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test.
Sure.
About in the 60s, they got an old school bus. They painted it paisley, and they, you know, said, you're either on the bus or off the bus. They went across the country doing God knows what. But I'm working right now with my publisher and some bookstores and old friends around the country. I'm planning a Crooked Heart book tour.
All right.
Going to get a van and going to put the Crooked Heart World Book Tour. We're going to end up in Ireland. I'm not sure how we're going to get across the ocean yet. We're still working on that. Logistics, you know, are hard.
Right. Yeah.
Anyways, and then on each side, my wife's going to paint Crooked Heart World Book Tour, and then on the back, you're either on the bus or off the bus.
Love it.
Like Ken Kesey, you know.
Jim May is the author of Trial Guide for a Crooked Heart. He's a storyteller. You can find him regularly at the Woodstock Opera House and all the other places he'll be this summer. Jim May, thanks for being here. Good to see you.
It's been a pleasure, Justin.
All right. Jim May. Jim's an old friend of mine. I feel like I've known him forever. I've seen him perform. There's tremendous stories that I've grew up with. There's a story about a Taylee Po. I want my Taylee Po. There's a lot of ghost stories. I grew up with storytelling all around me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the unbelievable experience of being a producer for Studs Terkel. Got to meet Garrison Keillor. Got to meet a lot of the people. Worked with Ira Glass for a long time. So I feel like it's the culture and the art form of it has been around me both in my personal and professional life for a long time. So it's great to talk to Jim about that because it is true. That snake story is a Brer Rabbit story. That's another story. That's a tribe story. All the stories that we know, the sort of, you know, anything, even the stories that we see on movies,
mm-hmm,
are just stories that have been handed down. It's interesting.
I would like to see if we can unearth the audio of the interview you did with Jamea.
I know.
10.
Right? There is video.
Ah.
And I think that's what he's talking about because I remember one year we got a VHS, you know, that was also like a camcorder,
yeah,
where you would have like the thing on,
yeah,
your shoulder,
yeah,
but it also you'd
put
have to carry the VHS
in.
With you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And we had that. And I think I've seen that tape where it's me with my braces and me interviewing people in a chair where they're like, well, what are you thankful for? Christmas is a great time, isn't it? And then some smart Alec 12-year-old thing to say, you know. And I had a good look going. I just remember that. Seeing that, I'm like, that's a lot. That's pretty short on the top and pretty long in the back, Justin.
Are we talking about a mullet?
We were, yeah. I have something to say about that.
Attaboy.
Oh, no.
When I was, my best friend in high school, freshman year of high school, was named Richie Fraschella, and he was an Italian guy. And he got a perm.
Mm-hmm.
Right, he had a long-haired perm, and it was kind of dope, you know, like it had a good look. But it, you know, he had black hair. It was like, so I'm like, I want one of those, man. So because I'm not a good orderer, you know, at the restaurant, I'm not a good hairstyle guy. I'm not a guy who goes in and goes, you know, can as a 13 or 14 year old be like, hey, here's what I want.
Yeah.
What I ordered was feathered on the top, perm in the back. As I have my long hair down to my shoulders. And that has been immortalized in a yearbook photo.
Now, did you win in the toy poodle category?
I had a perm, man. And I remember the hairstylist, and I think my mom and my dad are like, what are you doing? Like, you know, like I went and like you get driven by your mom to the place, but you get to go in and say what you want. I was also the guy later, when I got later in high school, I started doing the more Yo MTV rap, shave things into my head. Kind of thing, you know, like a message in the back of my head, like my name or something like that.
Wow.
But yeah, it's not
wow,
good. I'm very, very happy with the fact I have no hair. Is now I can't make terrible, terrible choices like I made in high school. This one, and the worst part is I went to take the yearbook photo sophomore year, I remember this, with wet hair. So the perm is kind of wet, so it like just kind of glot. It's the worst photo in the history of photos. And it, and needless to say, I didn't have a good sophomore year. I'm not going to lie to you. That was, I came out of the gun. I had a lot of confidence. I was asking a lot of girls to the dance, but it wasn't really going my way. But all good. You know what? I'm okay. Okay. If somebody has that picture, I'd love to see it. If someone would go to the McHenry West yearbook from like 1990 or 91, 92. Yeah. I can't remember what it is. You might be able to find it. I think I'm wearing a hat too. Like a neon hat on top of it.
You can wear a hat in pictures?
I think as a yearbook photo, right? Like at the beginning of the year, you take it. It wasn't like the cool senior picture where I wore like the sweater with the cool sweater. Like a real fluffy wool sweater. Yeah, it's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Nice little Parks and Rec theme song there from Pete Zimmerman. Appreciate that. Dave Schwann's in studio with me. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. To commemorate that anniversary, WGN Radio's Dave Schwann put together a great series of reports on some of the national parks here in the Midwest. Everything from the dunes to the parks along Lake Superior back down to the newest park in Pullman. Dave's got you covered.
You do. Thank you.
He's with me now in studio tonight. We'll talk about the national parks, what they mean to the people that surround them and use them on a daily basis. We'd love to hear from you. What are your favorite national parks in the Midwest? Or better yet, I mean, the country.
411.
411. We share our love for Yosemite, and we'll talk about that in just a second. 312-981-7200. Text or call in. What's your favorite national park that you visited in this country? Dave Schwann, good to see you.
Good to see you, Justin.
It's good to have you down here, too. You know, right. Usually I see you up on the seventh floor. All right, so let's talk. Why an interest in putting together this series?
Well, basically, it started last year when President Obama was here to designate the Pullman area on the far south side as a national monument, the first national park place that will be maintained by the National Park Service in Chicago. And up until last year, we've only had one other in Illinois, and that was Abraham Lincoln's home. And that's only been supervised by the National Park Service since about 1971.
Wow.
That was a state historic site for a long time, up until that time. And then the Park Service moved in and just changed a lot of things.
We think of parks and you think of trees and lakes and things like that. But this is different. In the state of Illinois, we're talking about monuments and historic landmarks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The National Park Service takes in many different things. But during President Obama's remarks during the dedication last year, happened to be there because I was working on a series on Pullman, but he mentioned that 2016 would be the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service in the country. And while, frankly, other countries have park services and so forth and preserve things, nothing is like this anywhere else in the world, that what we have here in our country.
Right.
And as I was listening to him speak, I thought, there's an idea for a series next year. So I was rolling it around in my mind all this time. And first of this year, Judy Pilak and Todd Mandley were on board with this. And they gave me
the
go-ahead,
and
I thank them.
And I like it because you're in the spot. And you talk about, in your series, you're really talking about the Midwest. Talk about, the parks that are along Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, because as you mentioned, Illinois just has the Abraham Lincoln spot in Springfield and Pullman.
Pullman, right. But those are, again, national parks.
Right. On the other side, you've got, when you go up the Michigan side, you're getting more national parks that people know in this area.
You're right. And while you go into Michigan, you have the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore.
Right.
Which is situated between Gary and Michigan City, having its 50th anniversary as a national park. Interesting story about the Indiana Dunes. When I think his name was James Mather, from the Chicago area, became the first superintendent of the National Park Service in 1916, one of the first places he wanted to maintain and preserve was that dune area
right.
there along the very, very
Michigan,
southern
yeah.
tip of Lake Michigan. And a lot of things got in the way. As you, obviously, there's a lot of industry there.
I was going to say, that's an industrial corridor.
There's a very much an industrial corridor. And even into the 1950s, there was a feeling among some people there that, that weren't really worth saving. Some people said, just leave it be, let it go. It was an Illinois senator, a U.S. senator from Illinois, Paul H. Douglas, that approached President Kennedy about saving this and making it a national lakeshore. How do we do this? And there were other aspects about that, you know, with industry, as you say, an industrial corridor. They came up with a compromise. As a result, they got the Port of Indiana, an international
right,
port,
right.
And the acreage for the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. So it finally became what it is now in 1966.
And that's the one that people in Illinois, at least, are going to know best because it's right over the border in Indiana.
Right around the corner.
That's a huge tourist attraction, especially
yes.
in the summertime. People are there all the time, even though they've had some problems with dunes and things like that in the future.
Yes, they
But
have.
Let's talk about, you go up to Traverse City there,
right.
and you go up to the UP. That's national parkland, sort of Midwest style.
It very much so. And to start with the Sleeping Bear Dunes, if you just want to go north up the lake. Sleeping Bear Dunes became a national lakeshore somewhere in the early 1970s also. But you've got dunes that are 300-400 feet in the air that have at least a 60-degree
yeah.
slope. They're just stunning. Not only that, acres and acres and acres of wooded areas and wildlife that has all been maintained and preserved. There's a beautiful drive that you can take with a car,
yeah.
a bicycle called
I've
the Pierce-Stockton
yeah.
Drive. Not only is it beautiful winding through the wooded areas, there are stops along the way where you can walk out and look over the lake.
It's unbelievable. My cousin had a wedding up in that area not too long ago. And when I went up there, I drove up. And when I got to that area, and it's great the way that the park ranger or whoever you talked to in the piece talked about it being kind of like the Caribbean. The way
yeah.
that the you know, when you get up to that area. But it was just amazing to me. Like, I was like, this is California-like. I mean, this
mm-hmm.
is unbelievable land.
It is. And because of the way in which the dunes were formed, they're remnants of the glacier area. We're looking at remnants of the Ice Age 20,000 years ago, which was how the Great Lakes themselves
yeah.
were formed. And they gave us this spectacular beauty.
312-981-7200. Call and let us know what you think of the national parks in the area, which ones that you like, any sort of facts and figures that you want to throw at us. So we're curious as well. Also, talk about not just in this area. I mean, Pete and I were talking about some of the national parks he was talking about in Texas. I was talking about in California that, mm-hmm. that we visited. Dave Schwann's in studio with me. We're talking about his series on the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, talk more. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio with me, Dave Schwann, WGN Radio, talking about his series about the National Park Service anniversary, 100 years, which is really tremendous if you think about and it's also not that long a time.
I know, 100 years.
That's what kind of blows my mind a little bit.
Actually, you know, the first national park was Yellowstone, and it was named such in the 1860s.
Okay.
Late 1860s.
But there wasn't a service.
But not a service, not a park system, an organized park system. It was just land that was set aside, and one thing led to another, and it evolved into the National Park Service.
You know, we were talking about Yosemite. I mean, I learned from the tour in Yosemite that it was Teddy Roosevelt that was a big conservationist who
yes.
helped sort of usher in the national park system
exactly.
as we know it. Yeah.
That's right. That's absolutely right. He was out there and saw that irreplaceable, indescribable, beauty that's out there. Unless you're Ansel Adams or somebody like that, spectacular photographer, pictures don't do it justice.
No, it doesn't. It's amazing. I mean, if you haven't been to Yosemite, it's in California. I guess it's west of San Francisco.
Well, like west you'd be in the ocean.
Oh, sorry, east of San Francisco, right?
But, about 2 to 3 hours east of San Francisco,
and it's sort of a carved out from the glaciers valley with huge peaks and waterfalls and everything that you would expect to see on a calendar is at Yosemite, and they were able to protect that.
Yeah, they were. A gentleman by the name of John Muir, M-U-I-R, was very instrumental in protecting that and maintaining it. Yosemite became a national park, I think, soon after the Park Service was found. But if I could tell a story,
please,
and I'm sure you could relate to this as well, and I think anybody that's been to a place like Yosemite can identify with this. A good friend of mine got married out there.
Wow.
Over 25 years ago. He and his wife would go skiing there. They live in California. They'd go skiing, and they liked it so much that they decided they were going to have their wedding there, and they did. Well, we all got in a few days before the wedding and stayed in the park, actually. And on my first day there, he said, "I'm going to show you around." And he was just being real coy. I says, "Turn left here, around this way. And I want to show you one more view." And it was the view of what the standard photo, more or less, is of Yosemite, the Bridal Veil Falls.
So good.
Valley.
Yeah.
I will never forget seeing that for the first time. I was stunned. I was positively stunned. And I was fortunate growing up to take vacations all over this country, and we did a lot of national parks, Yellowstone, et cetera, et cetera. And I always appreciated it, but that experience
so beautiful.
In Yosemite hit me and said, yes, we need to protect these forever.
312-981-7200. What national park hits you? Let's go to Bonnie. Bonnie, talk about what your favorite national park experience has been.
Oh, well, I really appreciate the show that you're having, because they are a treasure, and to see the United States is what we have here is just fantastic. My favorite is one that not a lot of people go to. They go to the south rim of the Grand Canyon. The north rim of the Grand Canyon is, I believe, my favorite.
Why? What distinguishes the north from the south?
Well, first of all, the trees, the greenery,
it's more green,
is just, oh, in September. I always would go in September to go to go camping on the edge of the north rim.
That's crazy.
The Grand Canyon. And I have to say, I was in a trailer, so because of physical condition, I can't sleep in a tent, but I've never seen it so dark in my life or so beautiful. But the colors during the day were so different than the south rim. But the fir trees, just all those beautiful fir trees, it felt like, after being at the south rim, it felt like heaven. We drove from Chicago out to the south.
Wow, that sounds like quite a trip. I would say that's probably the best way to do that.
You're lucky to have spent time at the north rim. It's not accessible year round like the south rim is. So you're lucky to have experienced
that. That's why people don't know it. Yeah. Well, the Grand Canyon is obviously a fan favorite for people when it comes to the national parks. But you know, let's continue the conversation. We'll take a break to get to Martyr in the news here, and we'll continue afterwards. 312-981-7200. I'm talking about some of the national parks out east. We haven't talked about the national parks up in the sort of New England area, Maine.
Acadia National Park.
That's an amazing park. And we'll continue the conversation here. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Dave Schwann from WGN Radio, his series on the anniversary of the National Park Service. 100th anniversary is up at WGNradio.com. You kind of put them all together because they air almost like it's a minute package
throughout the 90 week. 90 seconds. Yeah. They've been airing this week. The final 90-second segment will air tomorrow.
Okay.
But you can go to WGNradio.com, and they're right on
the
home page.
The photos and the slideshows.
Yeah, right.
Really
National
nice.
Parks are Midwest treasures. And we're working on a podcast, which probably will be up next week.
Okay, so the people that use the parks, I mean, because you had such interesting people that you interviewed, from park rangers and to the backstories of the people that either were part of that land or live next to the land. Talk about the relationship between the parks and the people that surround it.
Well, first of all, the people that work in the parks, no matter where they are, whether they're a nature park like the Dunes, Sleeping Bear, or Abraham Lincoln's home, they come from all different walks of life. Some of them we talked to were in the Army for a while. Others have backgrounds in history, geology, science, the arts, all different types of things, and they have gravitated toward areas that fall into their expertise. A historian, for example, Dale Phillips is the superintendent of the Abraham Lincoln Home in Springfield. We had a nice talk with him down there. He's been in the park system for 40 years, and that was a rather prestigious. Hmm. He put in for that job, he told me, and eventually worked out that he would be there. They have been reassigned to various places. Bob Krumenacher is the superintendent at the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore in Wisconsin, but he was at Valley Forge. You were mentioning parks out east.
Absolutely,
yeah, he was at Valley Forge before he came out to the Apostle Islands. And the local people in the areas there, they love it, as the people that I've known. They're very proud to have something like that. And I know for a fact that when Pullman was finally designated as a national monument,
of course,
that was a grassroots effort by those people that have lived in that area of our city.
That's a historical landmark in the way that that's the first sort of industrial, organized,
planned industrial
town.
Community.
Right,
yeah, right, exactly. Everybody lived and worked really in the same place.
That's so amazing.
And, not only that, but as we pointed out in our series and in various stories, a very violent and tragic labor strike in the 1890s.
And as you mentioned, that's how Congress
ended up giving us Labor Day as a holiday.
Huh.
Yeah.
I just think in my head, I'm like, what is the town outside of Seattle? Redmond,
Washington.
Redmond, Washington, in 100 years, they're going to make that a national park because that's where Microsoft is at. Right? Or Apple or whatever things, right?
Might.
Yeah, right, they might. But I mean, you mentioned Valley Forge. Obviously, we all know Valley Forge because of the Battle of Valley Forge. We just now talking about Pullman. There's reasons for these to be designated national parks. Are there any situations where national parks are just designated because it's just beautiful? Where they're like Yosemite, where they're like, no one's touching this.
Well, sure. And that was the chief reason for a Yosemite or Yellowstone. There's one in a couple in Utah, actually. Bryce Canyon National Park has to be seen to be believed. Those rock formations are unbelievable. And one of that's on my list that I have not been to, is on my to-do list, is Arches National Park out in Utah as well. These places are, you know, you talk about the wonders of nature. It boggles your mind.
Yeah.
It really does.
606 says, being from Wyoming, there's nothing better than hot springs, geysers, and hot mud pits of Yellowstone. And then they also said Redwood National Forest.
Redwood National Forest, definitely. The trees that are some of the oldest living things on the face of the earth there.
Are the Everglades a national park?
Yes, Everglades are a national park.
Okay, I'm just trying to think of the ones I've been to.
Right, Everglades, a big national park.
Yeah, right.
It's the southern part of Florida.
Right.
Fascinating area to visit.
Okay, so you got that. And then you think of California, like we said, the Redwoods. 847, the favorite national park is Arches.
National Park, and there's, again, rock formations there that over how many, you know, millennia, millions and zillions of years that have taken place, shaped by the wind.
312-981-7200, tell us your favorite national park. I'm trying to think, like, if you were going to do a day trip, in the state of Illinois, if you lived in this area, what are your choices when it comes to national parks?
National parks would be the Lincoln Home in
Springfield. The Dunes.
The Indiana Dunes, National Lakeshore. For a day trip, that would be...
A lot to get
a
up.
A lot.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, let's say a weekend.
A weekend? Oh, yeah. Yeah. And not only Abraham Lincoln's home, but, you know, the whole Lincoln Monument down
yeah.
there is,
well, the,
is
the, where museum,
the city
the,
is. The, right. Oh, the Abraham Lincoln Museum and Presidential Library
yeah, right.
is amazing. I want to point out one thing, too, Justin, is I feel bad about the fact that we just couldn't get all to all
right,
of them.
Right.
There are more than you think in the Midwest, and we're talking about Lincoln. His boyhood home in far southern Indiana, not far from the Kentucky line, is a national park
okay.
also. Well worth visiting.
Okay.
Definitely.
So a lot of it in this area, I mean, when you think of Indiana, you got the Dunes, you got the boyhood home, you've got Indiana, in Illinois, you've got Springfield, you've got Pullman. What about Wisconsin? Does Wisconsin have national parks?
The Apostle Islands National
okay,
Lakeshore.
Right.
It's
yeah.
a long drive up there. I can tell you it's a long drive. What they're working on, though, in northern Wisconsin and into Minnesota is a national trail that when it's complete... I've been told that it will be as long or longer than the Appalachian Trail that goes up
wow.
the east coast of the United States. It will stretch from New York State and all the way around northern Ohio, I guess. I'm not quite sure how it's going to work. I was talking with Paul Labovitz, who's the superintendent of the Indiana Dunes, was telling me about how all of this was going to work. But it's going to go, it's going to end up in like Montana or something.
I mean, I don't know if you know the answer, but like how often are national parks designated? I mean, we had the big unveiling with President Obama here for Pullman, but how often are new areas of this country designated national parkland?
It can vary. A national park, a full-fledged national park like Yosemite, Yellowstone, Acadia National mm-hmm. Park out on the East Coast, is it really kind of an act of Congress? You know, if somebody puts a bill through our lake shores, for instance, Indiana Dunes, Sleeping Bear, you know, that's, you know, legislators, lawmakers are
they
involved.
Have to, yeah,
but,
right, right.
For instance, Pullman being a good site and a brand new area in Hawaii, which will talk about the history of forced imprisonment
oh,
during
wow.
World War II.
So there's usually like
President Obama, the president can designate this.
Okay, okay.
And that's what he did for Pullman.
And there is a difference between, like we said, between national parks and state parks. People
oh, yeah.
get confused a lot because there's great state parks in the state of Illinois, like Starved Rock is
yeah.
a state park.
There's a day trip.
Yeah, right, right.
right there, sure,
and people would think
Rock.
That's a national park, but that's a state
yeah,
park.
Yeah, it's a state park along with other parks. Pierre Marquette State Park.
Mm-hmm.
New Salem, which is another Lincoln site in the Springfield area, that's a state park. That's not part of the national park area there. Lots of state parks.
Okay, let me go to some of the texters that are texting in here. 815 says Shawnee National Forest.
Shawnee National Forest. Yeah, that's with the Department of Forestry.
Okay, so forests are different than...
Yeah, that would be a national forest, but we were going to include that in this series until we found out it's not a national, under the National Park Service.
So the there's a National Forest
yeah. Oh, yeah.
area that's different
right.
than National Parks.
Right.
I didn't know that.
Right. There's a Redwood National Forest, Redwood
oh.
National Park.
Okay. There we go. 606 says, don't forget Moab. Moab?
Moab.
Moab, the desert?
Moab, yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
That's a national park?
Yeah, it is, and there are other national monuments out in the western part, southwest part of the United States that talk about the amazing story of Native American culture.
That's a
country.
Big part.
What was
going
on 10,000 years ago in this country?
Jeez. Not sure if they have a park, but the Badlands are beautiful.
Yes.
Is that a national
Badlands.
Park?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Mount Rushmore is a national park
right,
out
right.
in that part of the country. Yeah.
And then the last one here, 219, says, where exactly is Sleeping Bear?
Where exactly is Sleeping Bear? The most familiar town or city is Traverse City, Michigan. But it's actually about 25 miles outside Traverse City, adjacent to the small town of Empire.
Right.
Empire, Michigan.
There you go. and then, yeah, I mean, it's great. People are coming around here. 312 says the ones in Alaska are amazing.
Oh, Denali National Park has to be seen to be believed. It just does.
This is great. I'm telling you, you know, Bertrand does the going around the world with the tours.
Oh, yeah.
He's doing a national park tour. Dave Schwann's national park tour.
I'm still recovering from the week.
The Midwest.
From Midwest.
815 says Glacier National Park
Glacier,
in Montana.
Absolutely.
Love that.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes.
And then we have the Midwin National Tall Grass Prairie.
Yeah.
Is it a national monument? That's
yeah,
7-7.
National monument. Right.
There you go. So right. much to learn. Dave Schwann, you can find all his reporting at WGNRadio.com. It's up on the front page right now with a slideshow. Podcast will be coming out soon.
Hopefully next week on WGN Plus.
Love it. Dave Schwann, thanks so much for coming
in. Oh, you're welcome.
Being a part of it today.
Thank you, Justin.
Ooh, I like this song. What's that one, Pete? What is that? I like that.
Is that a Passion Pit?
Oh, you can't go wrong with a Passion Pit. You really can't. I feel like I, early on in my new iTunes experience, I had this experience where because I hadn't synced it right, maybe about 5 years ago, like I lost all the music that I collected. You know, it's just, of course, it's just the way it is. So I had to start over, which is actually kind of awesome. I loved it because I was like, well, besides, and I, you know what? I don't think I've paid for a download because every year, you know, I made the joke at the beginning of the show that I just want socks. And people don't know what to get. So like my mom just gets me an iTunes
gift
card.
Yeah.
So I just load that up and it's just like covered. Like I haven't paid for a song. So I'm like, okay, so what's going to be my first song? Right? What's the first song in your collection?
The first song like you'd ever. You just want to pick your favorite song of all time.
That's where I was like, okay, so I need to, it's like, it's kind of a fun game. What was the, if you do like, I think you can do it chronologically, like on your iPhone, like what was the first song that you actually downloaded? Yeah. It's fun. Maybe we do that like at 10 o'clock.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Mine was Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg. It was, I forgot to still Dre maybe.
Because do you think of like, okay, I just need this song. It's like my favorites, or it's like, this is a song that I know I'm going to go to all the time.
I think it was, I mean, it's still when it comes on, you know, it's still when it gets in shuffle and that song comes on, I'm like, all right, I'm going to keep this one on. Right, there's some that you've had for a long time. You're like, oh, I really can't listen to this Drake song again. Oh, I can't really listen to this Guns N' Roses song that I downloaded. November Rain was a close second.
I love that song.
That song's so good. It's so I think it was Dre and then November Rain, then a Prince song. Then like Erotic City or something like that.
I know you go through your, when you're like searching for songs and I can pinpoint ones where you came home maybe late at night with a couple of cocktails in you,
mm-hmm.
and they start getting on your iTunes downloading songs. You're like, why do I have this song? You know, why do I have this? Why is this song on here? There you go.
I once had an experience where I was trying to convince a friend who was having a party to play Ride Like the Wind. This was before streaming services, so you had to download it. So I downloaded Ride Like the Wind by Christopher Cross.
Yeah.
And it was like a live version, you know, and it just, I was like, I felt so bad. I was like, I'm so sorry. I just gave you the live version. I don't know how you're ever going to get rid of that. And I have one like that, too. I downloaded for some dumb reason. I downloaded Karate Kids, You're the Best Around.
Oh, yeah. To get you pumped at the gym?
Yeah. But then it was like, it wasn't that version. It was like a different version. So it was like almost like a cheese ball version of it.
Like a karaoke version.
Yeah, right.
Or, yeah.
You're the best. Yeah. Around. And, like, and I was just like, I can't get it off of the, like, it's still, I try to delete it. It keeps coming back. Anyway. Lots coming in on national parks. You should have asked Schwani for his, don't they like Dan? Yeah, this was more like, should ask Schwani for one of his far-flung forecasts from a national park. He's great to listen to with Uncle Dean. He's great. One of the best national parks to see is Olympic National Park in the west side of Puget Sound between Seattle and the west coast. I like that. That sounds like it would be great, right?
Oh, yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. A really, really long text about EPA emissions. I can't keep going back to it. I want to. They want to. It's like drawing me back in.
I love the fact that you can talk about this at 7,
and then 2 hours
then texts,
later. Yeah,
texts are coming in at 10.
Do not know if it's true, but one police officer claimed they were not given any notice by the Illinois EPA of the possibility of such a large turnout by drivers. I did notice a, quote, help wanted sign in the front of the air team facility about a month ago. Maybe they were just expecting more people to show up before June 1st. Also noticed the Illinois EPA website under testing station. Wow, they did a lot of work. A view live station queue cameras. Yeah. Yeah. I had the same problem. This is what caused me. This is what I talked about. It's that dumb technology, which essentially shows you a picture from 1 minute ago from any emissions testing facility, and it tells you what the weight is.
Yeah.
The wait that ended up being 2+ hours was categorized as 13 minutes on the site because they only count when you get in the line. They don't count the three-mile stretch, yeah. Or in the case in Chicago, 1 block that just didn't move. But the point being that, like, yeah, because someone said earlier, you can go on there and they're only 2 minutes long.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, don't say that to me, man, because that's why I went to Addison.
Yeah.
I'm like, by the time I did a numbers game in my head, I was like, 28 plus divided by 4 equals 2. Okay, yeah, you know what? I'm going to save 8 minutes. And I get to listen to my Apple Music, listen to my Dre song.
that's not good.
No, so you thought, I got duped. It said, the one in Chicago said 24 minutes, and I'm like, well, it looked like it was more than 24, but maybe it was moving. I should have stayed there. And then the one, like, in Addison said 12 minutes. And I'm like, oh, 12 minutes, and then Google Maps told me it was 20 minutes to get there.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, so I'm going to lose about 2 minutes, but really in Chicago it's going to be longer because I could tell it's going to be longer. That's wrong. And I got out there and it was a mess.
It's like when when you run the marathon, you know, you get so far back and before you even hit the start line, it takes you like 25 minutes to get to the start line.
They count that?
So I always say like, oh yeah, I did it in 5 hours. But really it was about 4.5, you know, because it took me that long to get to the finish line or the starting point.
Oh man, you know what's so great about I wanted to tell you about the story that happened to me in Glacier Park in Montana when I was a kid. I was out there and we were camping along a river, and I was going to tell that, and I got totally sidetracked by iTunes and emissions. But I went out there, we were camping, and we had these like old rusty forks and spoons that like were part of the camping outfit. You know, like yeah, we put the yeah. thing, we had like, you know, and sure. It was like they connect so they can compartmentalize. This old, yeah. You know, this would have been the 80s. And we were riding this beautiful spot. I mean, my mom and dad did such a good job of like just picking the greatest spot. I mean, we were going to be eaten by bears. It was such a good spot. And I was trying as a kid to undo those because, you know, my dad was cooking something and we were going to do it. And it was rusty. And I, as you could tell, and I'm sorry to say this, but I like undid the fork and it went through my hand.
Oh.
Yeah. It just went right through.
Like
puncture? I don't think it went through to the other side of my hand, but it was like enough to be like shock. Like, it just started bleeding, you know, down the hand. And I was like, maybe, I don't know how old I was, maybe 12. And my dad, but you're nowhere near a hospital.
Yeah.
You're miles from civilization. And my dad, like, tourniquet, like, did the whole thing to, and saved it. It was fine once I calmed down. And I still have on my hand, if you ever meet me, say, can I see your hand? There's
a scar?
There's a scar right in the middle of it. Yeah. On the palm of my hand, or like the inside.
So what you eventually?
It was fine. He wrapped it up. The blood kind of went away, and then like I just kind of held it for like, you know, I just dealt with it for, you know, the next day. In retrospect, revisionist history, I'm like, yeah, I dealt with it. I was oh man, what a trooper I was. Which is total bull. I'm sure I remember in my head. The only thing that's like a little snag. Is that I know that I was okay. I remember being like mad that we were there, like mad that I couldn't, like, you know, I can't believe
where no one's around.
Yeah, how irresponsible that, you know, I'm this far away from a hospital. Come on, like that's somehow in my head, but that's totally ridiculous. But yeah, so that's my national park story.
That sounds terrible.
It was, you know, We also jumped from rock to rock, so it was cool. All right, coming up, we're going to talk with Eric D. Johnson. He is Fruit Bats, who are headlining, or he is headlining, and his band are headlining Dew Division Fest, the street festival this weekend. Fruit Bats has a brand new record called Absolute Loser. It's getting rave reviews, and we'll talk with him about his music and his career coming up. Well, welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Fruit Bats is coming to Chicago this weekend for the Dew Division Street Festival. Fruit Bats is the music of Eric D. Johnson, who's a singer-songwriter. He formed Fruit Bats back in the late 90s when he was an instructor at the Old Town School of Folk Music right here in Chicago. He now resides in Portland. Johnson's been involved in several music projects, including his stint with the band The Shins, but he's back recording music as the Fruit Bats. He has a new album out called Absolute Loser, which is getting rave reviews, and he's my guest on The Download tonight. Eric, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what's it mean to get back to Chicago? I mean, what, you know, being here, being such a part of the scene that was that you were a part of in the late 90s, what's it mean to be back here to do this street festival?
It's still home in many ways. You know, like a lot of family here still, and it really still feels like home. I was actually just saying today I wish Chicago wasn't the most expensive Midwest city, because all my friends from Kansas City and St. Louis are like, I bought a brownstone or something, and they live on the West Coast, and they have their Midwest place, and I'm like, I'm from the expensive one of all of those, but it's still home, and that it's still, like, when I play, it still definitely feels like home, and also just kind of cool to play a street festival, because I grew up going to those. I feel like I saw stumbled into so many great shows in that way over the years, because it's like, you know, I lived in every neighborhood you could live in here, and you know, everyone has one. I feel like they've gotten better too as the music's gotten better. Usually you would just stumble on some weird cover band, and it was still great, but the Dew Division thing, I was like, oh wow, this is like pretty good curation. So,
well, I mean, you've gone to street festivals, and street festivals are not just a Chicago thing, but Chicago is a big part of it because of the city of neighborhoods. Talk about performing at one. What do you have to do differently as a musician playing in front of a crowd at a street festival?
I mean, I think normally we do our own headline shows. It's like an hour and a half, hour and 40 minutes set. To people who paid $20 to see us and to hear the songs they want to hear, kind of thing. And you can kind of like let the set flow. I think with the street, or really any festival, you got to kind of do the all killer, no filler set, which is nice. You have 40 minutes to do it, you know, so you really just pare it down to the stuff that you think is going to connect, because it's probably going to be half strangers in the audience that maybe don't know who you are.
So let's talk about, I mean, your time. I mean, you've been several different projects, as I mentioned, when you were here in Chicago, from the earliest iRobot stuff to Fruit Bats. Talk about what Chicago, what role Chicago played in making you a musician. I mean, now you had a lot of success with the Shins and with Fruit Bats on the West Coast. But talk about what it was about coming up in Chicago that formed you.
It was weird. I mean, it was an interesting time, for one thing, because it was the heavy, as far as the indie scene in Chicago went at the time, it was all about post-rock. It was all, you know, Tortoise, and every band had two bass players and a vibraphone player, and everybody was good. Everyone went to Oberlin, you know, and was like a really good player. And I was this singer-songwriter guy. I was working at the Old Town, which, like, it wasn't like that cool at the time, you know, to work there or whatever. It was very folky and a little older. I was definitely like at the time the young guy there. So it was weird, I had my little world, but it took a little while to find it. And that was, I ended up joining the band Caliphone for a while, who were a little bit older than me, and had sort of been more entrenched with their old band Red Red Meat. And so we're very like entrenched in the Chicago world. So I kind of got, and they were, very respected already and kind of veteran. So I went from kind of being very unambitious and had barely played any shows to kind of being in this band that was very well respected and went on tour and were really like a part of the world. So I owe those guys a lot. That was sort of my real introduction to the greater Chicago world, was like kind of, they sort of, I guess you could say, they plucked me out of obscurity a little bit.
That now. I mean, obviously with the new record getting rave reviews from all sorts of places, Absolute Loser seems to be, you know, a real turning point for you. But talk about, I mean, you've vacillated back and forth between sort of recording and being known as Fruit Bats and being known as yourself, Eric D. Johnson. You kind of have gone back and forth. Why back to Fruit Bats?
I think I was kind of trying to do this solo thing. I thought that it would be, I've been doing some film scores and producing other records and trying to do the maturing guy thing, you know, and be like, I'm going to be myself and whatever. But I realized really quickly that just the words Fruit Bat, for whatever reason, were my identity. It was really like when I tried to go out and do solo stuff, even though ostensibly it was like the same thing and the same catalog. This is really the short answer, basically, was that I had to put Fruit Bat in parentheses every time anyway. And mm-hmm. I was like, well, why don't I just go back to do that? It was a little bit of an experiment. It was just kind of a learning experience of like, and I think that's the way things work nowadays too, is it's the time of Google, you know, or Googleability, and just that kind of stuff matters more now than it used to. People didn't really follow me. And you need that thing to grasp onto. And I was like, well, I can either fade into obscurity or change two words back and do well again. And it worked. It really worked. So which I'm glad of.
Well, the record Absolute Loser is pretty personal. It's, you know, don't let the title fool you. There's upbeat songs. I mean, the music is very mature, especially the mix and the production of it is just tremendous, and the instrumentation, all that, the arrangement. But talk about where the record comes from, because it is very personal to you, and it sort of is a departure, if you will, from some of the other music you've produced.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it was like the EDJ record was a little bit like based around some turmoil and tragedy in my life, and that was the very personal. It was, you know, it was sort of my first foray into really doing something that was less impressionistic and was very confessional, I guess. And that was sort of I think it was well received, but it just wasn't received. Not a lot of people heard it. This Fruit Bats record does a lot about the sort of story behind that tragedy, but also the act of making that record too. It's a little bit, it's very much like about myself and kind of reacting to, it's a record about making a record, I guess. Mm-hmm. Very meta. It's a record about making a sad record, and writing songs. And, again, it's like, I think that last one sort of set me off into this very personal trajectory. So
do you, as a singer songwriter, I mean, even from your days back here in Chicago, does that come natural for you to be open and to be honest and to be personal, with your songwriting?
Not initially. I'm a pretty guarded person. So I think early on, if you listen to the lyrics, they were pretty, like I said, impressionistic, I guess, is the way to put it. It was maybe about something, but it was generally sort of under a lot of veils of things like that. So it was not in my nature. And I think I got sort of right around that time, I got really obsessed with Joni Mitchell and listening to Blue and stuff. And I was like, wow, I want to do something like that. I want to try to do something like this. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it took a lot, you know, to actually do that. So this is a new thing for me. And people have really responded well to it, which I think is cool, just that people are perceptive about that kind of stuff.
What was the transformation for you? I mean, obviously, was it things in your life? Or at what point did you make the realization that, you know, this impressionistic stuff, it can take me this far, but I really need to almost trust my fans and be able to be open in this space?
That's it. It's just maturing and just living life and going through things a little bit more. And I think it's, you know, it wasn't, I wouldn't say there's necessarily a single turning point or something like that. But yeah, where you're just like, you know, I can kind of keep doing this. And I think most writers, you know, maybe I will go back and do something deeply metaphorical next time or something. But most writers, you want to kind of try to change yourself. You don't want to write about the same thing every time. So I think right now I'm just kind of in this personal phase where I'm like, here, I'm going to tell you something about myself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for you, your music has been well received in indie rock circles. I think KEXP in Seattle has played a lot of your stuff throughout the years. Obviously, you know, being a part of the Shins, one of the really, really well-known band. What is it like for you to be a part of that scene, to be a part of that northwest? I almost want to say northwest side because I'm from Chicago. but up in the Northwest, like being a part of the Seattle, Portland scene, KEXP and the indie rock sort of genesis that comes out of those towns. I mean, it's so rooted in music.
Yeah. I mean, I think that all kind of came from those early days with Caliphone, because of the first tour we did was with Modest Mouse. And then also the Shins were, like, the first tour was 6 weeks with Modest Mouse, and the Shins joined us for two of those six. They were, like, unsigned at the time. And those were the guys, I just made friends with those guys for whatever reason. So I the Northwest stuff I fell into in an odd way, and then Sub Pop kind of came out of that. And then I ended up making a record out there and met my wife who lived out there. So I just was, I don't know. I really fell into the Pacific Northwest, and it seems to call to me for some reason. And I always really just liked the nature and the air and everything like that. It's very different from Chicago, obviously, but I'm sort of so those are my two homes. In a lot of ways, it's like two yin and yang kind of things. But, I feel very at home in both places.
Is it hard? Is it hard for you, Eric, and I say this as a fan of your music and as a fan of indie rock, especially Chicagoans. Is it hard to not almost be outside of yourself as a fanboy and be like, he's Sub Pop Records, the Shins, Caliphone? You know, I mean, these are almost the standard bearer names and record labels of indie rock's time, and you're a part of it. You're the heartbeat of it.
I'm still a fan, and I think most people I know in bands are. You kind of, or at least most cool people, most people I want to know are fans, you know, and most guys in bands. Like, we're all fans of each other, and that's the best part of it, really. Is like, I mean, it's great, and it's great to have anybody who likes you, but it's very cool to be respected by people that you respect so much.
Eric D. Johnson is a singer-songwriter. He goes by Fruit Bats. Fruit Bats will be at Dude Division Street Festival this weekend. The new record is called Absolute Loser, which is getting great reviews. The music is great. Eric, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to The Download and WGN Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Patty Vasquez, Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez, takes over. We are hoping to have an update after the news on the game one of the NBA Finals. Right now, the game, you know, basketball, for basketball fans, they know this, and non-basketball fans, is probably why you're not basketball fans. There are 3 minutes to play in the game. It's a big lead for Golden State. This will take an hour.
Probably.
It'll be fouls and stoppage for timeouts, for TV commercials. They get their Gatorade commercials in.
Mm-hmm.
And this 3.5 minutes will take 4 hours.
Yeah.
It'll be 2 o'clock in the morning, and they'll be like, there's 8 seconds to play.
I mean, when you have Steph Curry, you know, right. He could, I don't know. You could put it away real quick here with a couple of threes. They're up. Golden State seems to be up by, what, 10 or so?
They're up 11 with 3 minutes to play. And I get it. There's
still close.
Yeah. And, you know, there's Curry with the shot. Steph Curry with the shot. He dropped it. Three-pointer. So just like you said.
Mm-hmm.
Now he'll walk back. Now they'll take a timeout.
You have LeBron James, too, though, on the other side. You know, he could take over the game.
Well, listen to you. You're like the
watch a lot of Sports Center.
You're an analyst. You're the objective analyst. Is like, Steph Curry's great. He can win the game. On the other side, LeBron, he's great. He could win the game. And then they just hit it. Yeah, see, now they're in a timeout. Come on. Didn't they speed up the game in baseball for the pitching changes? Didn't they speed up the game in football? Like, mm-hmm. they tried to speed it up at the last 2 minutes. Like, I forgot, was it basketball? One of the sports, they did the thing where they tried to change the rules a little bit to be like, you can't call a timeout or you can't do something mm-hmm. late in the game.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, football speeds it up by not stopping the clock. Like, they do it in the last 2 minutes because of the drama of it. Like, you can get out of bounds, but, like, they won't stop the clock if it's, like, the middle of the fourth quarter and you step out of bounds.
Yeah, when we were at the Cubs game, I noticed that on the center field scoreboard, they have a clock. And as soon as, like, the last out is made, boom, 2 minutes. It starts running. It starts winding down.
For the next inning to start?
Yeah.
Hmm. Were you at the game where Jason Hammel had the hammy?
No.
No.
We saw old wooden teeth, John Lackey. That's my nickname for John Lackey when we come up to him and picnic.
Oh, old wooden teeth? I'm not sure if Esmeralda's going to like that one.
If
this doesn't really flow.
If you saw a picture of him, it's the perfect nickname. Old wooden teeth.
Old wooden teeth. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know if it'll fly.
You know what? That's for late. Maybe we do Lackey sooner than later just so we have that.
There's a jumping off point.
Oh, wooden teeth. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's finished. The game one of the NBA Finals goes to the Golden State Warriors with a big, decisive win on their home court. And this is kind of par of the course. You never really see LeBron James and any team he's been on jump out in front. He almost felt like every time the Bulls played the Cavs or Heat in any form, they'd win game one. And then we'd be like, well, Taj Gibson needs to be on a poster. He's the winner. We're going. And we're like, oh, all right, 1-1. That's not bad. All right, down 2-1. We can come back. 3-1. What's going? 4-1.
Yeah,
oh, my God. Down 40 points in the third quarter.
So you're predicting the
Golden State. I say Golden State, yeah.
And do you care about, you know,
basketball?
The Bulls' legacy against the Golden State Warriors' legacy?
No,
The Warriors lose,
I will say
not?
This. I always, when I get to the NBA Finals, try to find storylines and players that I want to root for. The Cleveland Cavaliers, I have no affinity whatsoever. I mean, LeBron James is a villain to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been in the way of the Chicago Bulls for years. I do everything by homerism. I do everything by how it affects the Bulls. So then I think, okay, and I don't like the Cavs because even when he was there before, when LeBron was there before the Heat, before he left, like Joakim Noah would just always make awesome jokes about Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like to go there.
Yep.
So there's not. I have no love lost. And Kyrie Irving, Kevin Love,
nothing.
Nothing.
No.
In Golden State, Steve Kerr.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right, Steve Kerr, Chicago Bulls. He was a great, unbelievable player for the Bulls here. You know, we go. See, the Golden State Warriors are outside the studio here. They have people with their shirt on.
Glanced up at the game and I saw Sean Livingston had like led the team in scoring,
yeah,
like
bench,
20 points.
The bench came, and that's I really like. The other thing too I would say is I really enjoy Golden State's game, and that's the way the Bulls are supposed to play in a Fred Hoiberg system. They're very similar, and that's they just have a lot of sharp shooters, and they throw them up and throw them up and throw them up, and they make them, and they have unbelievable play from Steph Curry, who we watched when it was drama time.
Mm-hmm.
He made the plays. So I guess that's the only – I think the only Chicago connection is Steve Kerr, correct? I don't feel like there's any other – there's no players on the Warriors that used to play in Chicago, and there's no players on the Cavs that used to play in Chicago.
No.
Right? Tyronn Lue is the Lakers guy, the coach of the Cavs now.
Sean Livingston's from Illinois, though.
Oh, okay. There
you know, he was a Mr. Illinois basketball, whatever. We played for
so you're,
Peoria
so you must. So you must be changing your tune. Are you a Golden State or Cleveland guy?
I don't want to see LeBron James. I like the fact that LeBron James only has one championship. But then I kind of want to see the Warriors lose because I don't want them to beat the Bulls' record of regular season wins and then win the championship.
But I already, just based on the fact they had to come back against Oklahoma City, they're out of that. I've lost interest in the Golden State Warriors and the Chicago Bulls. The Bulls are so much better. It's not even – I mean, I know I'm in Chicago. I've got the WGN Mike flag in front of me.
Yeah.
I understand I'm a homer. I understand I'm biased. But that Bulls team is nothing like this Golden State. This Golden State team, you know, is much – I will say they got the drama. They're champs. They're the best in the NBA. There's no doubt. But they're not the best ever. I would even say the Boston teams in the 80s and even the Laker teams in the 80s were better than what we've seen.
And I think most people that know about basketball, you know, your Stephen A. Smiths, your Skip Bayless's, you know, they say the same thing.
Yeah, so I'm interested in the – I liked the Golden State team because of Steve Kerr.
Yeah.
And I'd much rather have that than the – and maybe it's the same argument. Maybe you can make the same argument that LeBron James, Michael Jordan comparisons – are the ones I'm trying to protect.
Yeah.
I want LeBron, just like you, to lose as many as he can because I don't want that comparison because he compares in numbers.
Oh, yeah.
He's amazing. And he's an amazing player. And I give LeBron James respect. I just want to see him lose because I don't want them even to have the conversation. I don't want us to do a which is better, LeBron or Michael Jordan in 10 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's why I'm like, you. So I would much rather, I don't think there's a comparison. I mean, Golden State has to win four more. For it to even be three more, maybe, because the Bulls only did three, and they'd have to win next year and the year after.
All right, you convinced me.
Yeah, this is
Steve Kerr is pretty much the reason.
I guess this is Bulls Portland, what we're seeing here.
Yeah,
except LeBron James is better than Clyde Drexler. Remember that? I was like, Portland's pretty good. 773 says, I just want Cavaliers for the city of Cleveland. Why such?
We haven't won anything.
But I don't. You know what? I don't care. They haven't won in Milwaukee. I'm like, I wish Milwaukee would get it. Last time I checked, and I gotta say, you know what? I don't want to be that guy in the city of Chicago broadcasting, but last time I checked, the Cleveland Cavaliers were in our division. I don't care about the city. I don't. This is not a. Oh, I feel good for the people of Cleveland. No. Cleveland, the Milwaukee Bucks, the Detroit Pistons, who else is in the league? The you know, whoever else the other teams are that are in the Bulls division. I don't want them to win. Just like I don't want the Lions to win or the Vikings or the Packers or, you know, the Brewers or the Cardinals or the Twins. I don't go and go, it's good for the city of Minneapolis. If the Twins are good. I don't want any of those teams to win. Golden State, you know. Oh, they're showing some terrible Memorial Day beach violence stuff on the news on ABC7.
Were people beating each other up upon piles of garbage?
They were. It's exactly what it was. It wasn't enough that there was a ton of garbage. Now the story is that there were fights too. Which we, you know, if it's up to me, let's just organize them. That's all I'm saying. Organize it. Pay a ticket charge because every time there is any sort of summer holiday, there turns to be a fight on the beach. Yeah, $10 to get in. Fight all you want. Throw your Doritos wherever you want. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. I was just looking online, and Fox 32 has this story, Mike Flannery's story, that's up. Leaders of the Chicago Teachers Union don't agree with Republican Governor Bruce Rauner that often, but they did Thursday. Both say Chicago should tax itself for new school funds rather than wait for the state to send more money. That's kind of new in the sense that I think that they're just trying to force Rahm Emanuel to raise taxes, and he's the one who's Forrest Claypool responded, I'm shocked to see the Chicago Teachers Union surrendering to Governor Rauner and letting him off the hook for funding education properly. So here we go with that. And then I saw that, and you know, it's interesting, you know, we kind of saw these stories. The last line of this article, and I think it's Mike Flannery's words, I don't know if this is what his report was because it's the online version.
Yeah.
is it says, our advice to parents, start planning now for all-day child care in September. Don't count on schools opening.
What?
Huh. I mean, I understand the threat, and that's the threat. It's been the threat for, we always hear, oh, man, we didn't get a budget, so that's going to affect schools. But in the back of my mind, or at least I understand, there's just really no acceptable way that that happens. You know, that now it's time for the political posturing and the jostling and the sort of mudslinging. But there's no way that any lawmaker, I mean, we'd be talking about historic, that in the month of September they don't open schools because they don't have money.
Yeah. Well,
but you know what I mean? I mean, there's been strikes. There's been work stoppages. This would be, we ain't got no money, so we can't open the doors.
Yeah, that's, I
don't see that happen.
You know, I have friends that are teachers and whatnot, and they pretty much say that they're going to strike. The strike is happening,
okay.
And that's going to be a reason why school might not
start. No, I understand that. I mean, maybe that's what the line means if you read between the line. But the idea to say start planning now for all-day child care in September, don't count on schools opening, and the article was essentially about how far off they are for funding. Listen to this line, which is, I mean, these numbers, we'll talk to Fouché about it next week, but Chicago's $5.7 billion school budget counts on about $2 billion in state aid. The numbers we've been talking about has been, this year was about 400,000, 500,000. Now, maybe that's included, and I think it is, because it's that plus what they want. Claypool has warned that without additional dollars from Springfield, thousands of Chicago teachers may be laid off in September. But see, I mean, we've been talking about this for a year, and every other week there's that threat that, oh, we're going to lay off teachers. We had administrators were mm-hmm. cut. And it almost like just recycles the rhetoric. Like we're done with the spring session. We didn't get it done. So why don't we dial back the rhetoric to we're going to close schools and the whole world's going to end and you're going to have to homeschool your kid for the rest of it. We'll start there again. It just feels like I'm not sure that that's.
These are all empty threats?
I feel like it's, empty until it happens, I guess. You know, I don't know. It's interesting. I'm fascinated to see what happens. And I know that it seems to me like we might be in a situation where the governor will give specific amount of money, which will not be enough, and we will be on the hook for more taxes in the city of Chicago. Which, to be honest with you, I understand the need for it, you know, as a Chicagoan. You just have to ask the question, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg, in the sense that the reason they need to raise taxes, according to Governor Rauner, even in this article, Governor Rauner's quoted as saying, they have fewer kids, families are leaving Chicago because of crime and lack of jobs and a lot of reasons. I love that line. We'll start with crime and lack of jobs, just a little dig, and then a lot of reasons. But I'm willing to say let's put the same amount in, even though they have fewer students, as a stopgap, as a way to get through this crisis right now because, you know, I'm helping you out. So, and Rahm Emanuel and Forrest Claypool, they argue, we have 20% of the kids in the state system. We get less than 15% of state education funding. That's fundamentally wrong, especially when 86% of our kids are low income, 85% are African American or Latino. This is blatant discrimination.
Hmm.
That's what Claypool said. So, I mean, we're getting to the point where we're getting to the core ideology or core rhetoric. Now it's Governor Rauner is essentially discriminating against Chicago because these are black and brown kids. And I mean, it's interesting to hear a superintendent go there. You're hearing Governor Rauner say, hey, the math is simple. People are leaving. You got less kids. I'm going to give you less money. I'm a nice guy, so I'm not. I'm going to keep it. And then Rahm Emanuel says, no. You owe us more. I mean, I don't even know where the starting point is. What's the starting point in a negotiation? I people out there, we're going to wrap up the show here, but maybe tomorrow we can talk about it. Maybe you're a professional negotiator. Maybe that's what you do for a living. Where's the starting point here when one person wants more money, the other person says, no, I'm going to give you less. The other person says, okay, you're racist. Where do you start? Okay, guys, you do it like a car, like the car dealer did to me when I bought my Honda Civic. Where he said he gave us new, and he was excited. And I think I told this story before. And I got in there and I was all sleeves rolled up. I'm gonna fight this guy. And then I got mad at him when he goes, this is the rate. And I'm like, that's not the rate we talked about. I'll walk right out of here. I can't believe you just told me that. This is what I'm talking about. You guys are scamming me. And then I was like, huffed. And he goes, I see you use Gmail. And I filled out the form. I see you use Gmail. What's that like? What? Like he's trying to make from?
I
think it was like a common oh, okay, so let's get off of the financing of this and let's talk about email.
Yeah. And then maybe
That's what they need to do with Rauner, Manuel, and Claypool and everyone involved. So I see you here you use Earthlink. I do, yeah. Do you like Earthlink? It's better than you use Yahoo. Oh, you use Yahoo. Well, I can see we both use email. Because we both use communication tools. Great. What do you think about $1 billion? See, you're right. I'll do it. Let's get him in the studio. All right. Coming up, Patty Vasquez. That's going to do it tonight here on The Download. Coming up, Patty Vasquez. Pretty late with Patty Vasquez. Got a great show tomorrow night. Steve Gadlin will be back with the frying pan, of course. I don't know why. Oh yeah, tomorrow night. I'm so excited. The Goodman Theater's Bob Falls is going to be here. He'll be my guest at the big table. We'll talk about the Goodman sign fire. Just spend an hour talking about the Goodman sign fire. That's what we'll do.